Let us begin. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, August 28th, 2007, Carrboro Board of Aldermen public hearing. We do not normally receive comments on matters that are not on our printed agenda at our public hearing night, so those who would like to speak on matters that are not on our regular agenda are invited to come next week and to speak at that time, at the beginning of the next meeting. With that, we'll turn to our consent agenda. Is there a motion for approval of the minutes?
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Item B1, a request for minor modification for conditional use permit for Carmel Mall. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Mayor and members of the board, though this is listed at the beginning of the agenda, from a procedural standpoint, this item needs to be considered in conjunction with item four public hearing on the Alberta. So I'm going to ask if there be no action until that public hearing is completed.
Okay.
All right, so we'll basically consolidate the hearing on this item and
just move on
Alberta
to C1.
C1, temporary street closing request from St. Joseph CME.
Purpose of this item is to receive public input on a street closing permit application submitted by St. Joseph CME Church to temporarily close Broad Street between Fowler Street and Hill Street on Saturday, September the 8th, from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. for the Frangelism in the Park event. Staff doesn't have a presentation. Be glad to respond to questions if there are any.
Are there any questions from the board? We don't have any speakers signed up to speak on this topic.
Move public hearing be closed.
Second.
Moved and seconded to be closed the public hearing. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Move the
opposed.
Item.
Second.
It's been moved to grant the request. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously.
They had a really great program last year, and I encourage everybody to go to it this year.
And it'll be Saturday, September 8th from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. All right. Mr. Manager, item C2.
Okay, C2 is a continuation of the public hearing on the Ballantyne Architecturally Integrated Subdivision Conditional Use Permit request located at 8110 Old NC 86. The Board of Aldermen will continue a public hearing open on June 26, 2007 on a conditional use permit requested by MI Homes as represented by the John R. McAdams Company for the construction of a 96 dwelling unit subdivision located at 8110 Old NC 86. The conditional use permit, if approved, would allow the creation of 62 single family detached and 34 townhome lots with associated infrastructure, including publicly dedicated streets. And staff made the presentation at the public hearing in June, and we do not have a presentation.
We have one citizen signed up to speak on the matter. James Carnahan, if you would come up. Did you speak at our last public hearing, James?
I did.
So you were probably sworn in. So you're still under oath. Go ahead.
Good evening. I didn't realize until 4 o'clock this afternoon that the new planning board recommendation on this was not in your packets. So I got together with Thelma Paler, and much thanks to her for helping me get what you should have in front of you somewhere as a new recommendation, since the planning board had come to a tie vote in its initial conversation about this. We had further conversation on August 2nd. And have passed a recommendation that I'm just going to read a couple of elements of. Urge the Board of Aldermen to compel the developer to increase the number of units at Ballantyne to achieve the full build-out allowable under the current ordinance. At the very least, the Planning Board desires that MI Homes build the remaining 15 bonus market-rate units that will help to subsidize the affordable units. Otherwise, that burden will be passed on to the rest of the purchasers of Ballantyne units. And finally, the Planning Board supports a scenario in which the Board of Aldermen gives CUP approval for a portion of the project so the development may proceed while one of Ballantyne's distinct pods is redesigned to achieve the higher density. And that's it. And Questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This notion that otherwise the burden will be passed on to the rest of the purchasers, I guess what I want to know is how you know that. Because, and let me say, I'm not great at analogies, but the analogy that comes to mind is like if I have two cars to sell and one's a BMW and one's a Hyundai, I'm not going to sell the BMW for less if I have a second BMW to sell. I'm still going to get the market value. And so why do you think that the builder is not going to get the market value for every market home they build, irrespective of the number? Right? I mean, you're implying that the cost, if I'm reading this right, you're implying the price of those homes will be less if there are more of those homes? And is that right?
You're right. I can't say for absolutely sure. I don't have Ballantyne's numbers in front of me. Okay. But the purpose of having the market rate units as part of the bonus is built in with the assumption that there is some subsidy taking place of the affordable units, and that's why this incentive, one of the reasons the incentive is offered, but to claim it is an absolute
right. But
no.
The subsidy is really to the developer, not to the purchasers. I think that's an important distinction.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Your point is taken. I think that there's an answer, which is yes and no. You don't really know who the subsidy is necessarily going to. It's based on the theory, though, that in any development you have certain fixed costs, which are the infrastructure that's required by the town. In this case, and under our new rules in which we attempt to compel developers to include affordable housing in each new development, the subsidy for those affordable units is part of that infrastructure and part of those fixed costs. I think that's what you're getting at, correct? And so that how that cost is actually naturally spread between the developer and or providing perhaps some price incentive to buyers is spread out among a larger number of units. So how that spread ultimately ends up kind of just depends on how the market shakes out. As we know, the market is currently under pressure. And so in some respects, that lends, again, it's all theoretical, it's all economic theory, but lends, I think, some weight to the argument that James has made.
Well, I guess I don't see that it is economic theory. I think it's economic supposition, and I'd be very interested in data or hearing from a developer who came in and said, yes, when I learned I could get these bonus units, then I lowered my prices because of that, because that would be interesting to know. But my assumption is that your typical developer looks at what the market will bear, and that's the price they charge for a unit, and that's why we in fact have the affordable housing regulations we have, is because we're not going to get them otherwise. But anyway, I don't want to belabor that. I just want to be clear on, what it is that, that we're getting for that. I think there are other benefits, as the Planning Board articulates, for having higher density at that property.
I was going to add, but if...
Okay.
I think I'm done.
All right. For now. Okay. Are there others who wanted to speak on? Jay, were you going to speak on this item? You may need to swear me in again if you. I just wanted to make sure that you had appreciate your asking, Mayor. The memorandum from John R. McAdams Company, and their their agreement, and this is on page 2, with the NTAAC's recommendations, among which was to work with NCDOT on the final location of the shared County Park Valentine Street intersections and support a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit. And my thought, having dealt with DOT on the speed limit issue on Old 86, but for a much larger portion of it, was that in order to really effectuate this, the town board needs to not only say that this is appropriate for an area there associated with the park and with the Valentine Street intersection and the public work site entrance, but also delegate members of the board to meet with those officials to express that this is the will of the board and that there's a political aspect to your needing them to work to address this issue. If you support keeping the location at the current location of the road that leads into the park, it's a dirt road at this point. So that would be my request to you. Whether you adopt agree to the application tonight with that pending, it's up to you whether you do that or not. I guess I would prefer to have that settled before, but I understand if you chose not to. I think that's all that I'd say about that. I know you got a lot of work to do.
Jay, could you restate what the concern is for the options that you see about that entry road?
I think I don't have in front of me my the record of the recommendation. As you know, we had stated that we prefer to have no entryway into the park off of Old 86, that there were two existing ways to enter the park with the building of the subdivision and connecting, and one would be through Lake Hogan Farm Road and also Homestead Road and then eventually off of Eubanks Road. If the board chose not to wait for that and supported the county's request to have it off Old 86 as well, we feel that the site distance from the proposed location would be not as good as it would be from the existing location. The existing location was what the county proposed in their initial master plan. And the only reason that it's been moved or proposed to be moved by Ballantyne and the application is that they received a letter from Chuck Edwards of DOT saying that due to the speed along that road, the site distance wouldn't allow that driveway to be there. And I think that the last time I shared with you that if the speed limit is reduced, I believe that the site distance requirements for 35 miles an hour would allow the entrance to stay at the same location.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other members of the public? Robert, did you want to speak? Come on up.
I believe I'm sworn in from last time. I'll be brief. I just want to reiterate what I mentioned last time. I have no comments about Ballantyne, the development proposal, other than the affordable housing component, which is different. It's a little complex. They're under the old ordinance, the old affordable density bonus, and which allows them to price up to $140,000 and sell the homes to anybody, and they'd be deed restricted. And we proposed to them that we would purchase the units from them, three-bedroom units for $130,000, two-bedroom units for $120,000. And those prices are still unaffordable. And we would have to go out and get approximately $30,000 per unit in subsidy for each of the 17 units. 17 times $30,000 is $510,000 of subsidy required to make these 17 units truly affordable. If we can't get the subsidy, or for any reason we can't sell the units, we propose to them that they could have an exit strategy and sell the units themselves at the ordinance allowed price of $140,000 with deed restrictions. I don't think that accomplishes what the board is looking to accomplish, but I think that they need to have, they being the developer, need to have an exit strategy. So we're trying to capture these 17 units, or at least some of them, or if not all of them, as units that will be affordable initially and always be affordable. That's the objective. It requires $30,000 per unit subsidy. So that's all I have to say about it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Jack.
Okay. We're a little rusty. We've been out for a while. Usually rusty anyway. Tell me precisely what it is you would like us to do about that as we work through this tonight.
The proposal that the applicant has made to you all on the affordable housing side is pretty much as I just outlined it.
Okay.
And I think it's just important for you all to know that I think this is a better deal than just allowing them to sell them to anybody at $140,000, which is what happened at the Jones property.
Right.
I think this is better. But I'm you guys know me well enough, it's kind of full disclosure with me. I don't hide things. And $30,000 per unit, while in itself, in the world of affordable housing today in 2007, is not a lot of money per unit. We're looking to build a house on Broad Street, and we're looking at $75,000 of subsidy. So $30,000 absolute dollars is not a lot of money. But 17 times $30,000 is $510,000. That's a lot of money.
Right.
And I just want you all to be aware of that. And we're going to try and get the money. We're going to try various sources. But I can't guarantee today that we'll be able to get that money when it's needed.
So you're saying that we should accept the applicant's proposal and understand that somewhere down the line, you're going to have to come up with $500,000.
I may be coming back to talk to you about that.
I wouldn't be shocked. But
well, if I'm noting that figure is about close to, well, it's more than a quarter of our annual home budget, you know,
right,
we allocate for all the agencies and projects, mm-hmm, for the whole county. So certainly you'll be looking for some of those funds, I'd imagine. And, you know, so there are going to be repercussions.
Robert, I was wondering if you could clarify the idea that the affordable units had to be sold before the market rate units, that the market rate units couldn't precede the affordables.
I'm not sure how we structured that, Randy, to tell you the truth. I would prefer that they be done on a pro rata share.
Okay.
In other words, we don't leave the 17 till the end.
Right.
And then they don't have to be at the beginning either.
Right.
That if it's 15%, then that's as they go along, it should be 15% of the project roughly. Because they're townhomes, they're built in blocks.
Right.
There'll be blocks of four or five, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And so, and that should help us with the subsidy, because all 17 won't be done at one time. We won't need $510,000 in 1 month. It might be over 2 years, depending upon the build-out strategy. But I think it should be done pro rata, and I think you all can require they do that.
Just sort of a clarification question. If it's done pro rata and it's done at the certificate of occupancy time, and then so the time starts to run right then and there for a year, is there any, and this is for the board too, is there any method or policy for this one that we could have if there's some additional time, not an extremely additional amount of time, but more than a year?
To sell the units?
Yeah.
We've proposed to MI Homes that
they give us a year to sell mm-hmm. these units from the CO. That's a long time, Joel. I think if we can't sell a home in a year, there's troubles.
Okay.
There's either troubles with the home or there's troubles with the organization. And as I mentioned to you all last time, back in June, the organization has a lot of, we have a lot of volume coming to us.
Okay.
And I think that's when I say if we can't, for some reason we can't sell them, we're working already on trying to figure out how we're going to deal with all the volume that's coming to us in 2009, but that the structure's not yet in place.
Okay. My only other question is, have you worked out with the developer with regards to how many will be two-bedroom units and how many will be three-bedroom units?
I think we have, but I don't know that number offhand.
Okay.
If someone's here from the developer,
we'll ask,
maybe
we'll
ask
the developer that in a minute.
Okay. That's it from me.
Okay.
Your other, you have what, like 140 other units in the pipeline, am I remembering?
We're projecting, Dan, that we'll have about 150 units coming to us between now and the end of 2010.
Okay, and how many of those are needing additional subsidy to bring the price down?
A lot of them.
A lot of them, okay. So I just wanted to check that point, that that 500,000 is not,
that's not
your
the
total
only.
Need for the next
No. Year. There's going to be a large need for subsidy.
Okay, that's all. Thanks.
How many of those 150 are in Carrboro?
Claremont is 12, I believe. There's 17 here. That's 29. Those are the only ones that are in that on our spreadsheet. I haven't. There are others that are coming in Carrboro that are not on my spreadsheet. That's just 29 of the 150.
So only 20% of the 150 is in Carrboro, and 30 is not a lot. And I would encourage the board to understand that whatever subsidy is necessary, we're going to have to take it in bites. And don't let the amount keep us from doing it.
So Whittemore is already through and not included in those numbers.
We don't have any homeownership opportunities in Whittemore. There's 48 units of rental housing, and we're working with Crossland to do a tax credit deal there.
Right.
And that's for 08.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
We'll turn to the developer in just a moment, but is there anybody else who wanted to speak on this item? If not, one of the representatives of the developer like to come up and address the board. Even if you wouldn't like to come up and address the board, would you come up anyway so we can ask you?
Good evening. Again, my name is Kevin Hammack. I'm a landscape architect with the John R. McAdams Company. I've been representing MI Homes on this project for well these many years, especially since we originally submitted this project a little over 2 years ago for a conditional use permit. With me is Ed Christensen. He's representing MI Homes. He's actually with MI Homes.
Yes.
Can everybody hear me?
No.
Okay, sorry.
Are they sworn?
Kevin.
Okay.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm the evidence you're about to give the truth as your knowledge?
Absolutely. Yes.
First off, we would like to address the new planning board recommendations. This is frankly the first time we've seen this. We weren't aware that they had a new vote, I guess, to override their initial tie. I think it was a 4-4 vote. And specifically, we really would like to address their condition for increasing our density. We really feel that we've, in a good faith effort, done everything we can to meet the ordinance requirements, provide as much affordable housing as we can, and take advantage of the bonus density as much as we can. The property's base allotment would be 81 units. We're providing 96 units. 35% of those are townhomes. And I don't know, maybe Ed can add a little bit to that, but just looking at the market and what they feel like is a reasonable mix of product, we've got affordable townhomes, 2 and 3 bedroom. We have market rate townhomes. We have a mix of medium-sized single family and larger single family. And what we're trying to do is, rather than provide a monotonous one type of neighborhood, we want to provide a mix of different product. Also, as we increase density, our impervious surface is going to go up, our developable area is going to go down, and thus it'll even be harder to provide a good range of different product on this property.
Yeah, I'll echo what Kevin had to say, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here. I am new to North Carolina. I'm not new to MI Homes. And I was under the impression that we complied with all of the zoning regulations regarding density. And while I recognize that there's a responsibility as a landowner to meet zoning requirements, I also think that there's some rights once you have met those density requirements. So this comes as a very big surprise to me. And even though this was dated August 2nd, today was the first time, about 15 minutes ago, was the first time I'd seen this document. A couple of thoughts occur to me. We have been marching for 2.5 to 3 years along a stage with your planning and zoning personnel to achieve what we have before us tonight. We've spent a lot of time, energy, money, and honestly, at this late stage, this surprise, I think, in my heart, just seems very unreasonable. The diversity that Kevin referred to, I think, is accurate. We have a mix of product, mix of product sizes, a mix of price points throughout the entire community. I think it will be a very diverse and predominantly family-driven community with also a great deal of affordable product. I've been in this business a while. I believe it's very strongly what MI Homes will do. I believe very strongly that MI Homes will do a great job at whatever we choose to do. My initial reactions when I read the development text, which didn't prepare me for this document I received tonight, but did allude to someone wanting higher density as a citizen, I tended to think, gee, this is sort of, again, I'm not from the area, but I've driven around the area for the last month and tried to get to know it. The area is on the periphery of the city. It doesn't seem to me to be the proper place to increase density. It's not served by public transportation. It's sort of out on the perimeter of the city, and I would think it's the perfect foil for the kind of housing situation that we've worked with your staff to develop, and I thought tonight maybe had a chance to get it across the finish line. So I'm very disappointed. I don't know that the elements of what is intended to be achieved will be achieved by what has been presented to me tonight. Adding 15 units, there's only one section that I think can accomplish that out of the two pods that we have, and that section has dense hardwoods, a lot of natural terrain, beautiful topography, and frankly, that will be compromised severely if we take that plan that we've worked so long and hard to approve and throw it out the window. In addition, it seems to me that we spent well over $1 million and 2.5 years of time and energy getting to the point where we thought we had a reasonable basis for an agreement tonight. And I think it's an unfair burden to throw this at us at the last moment without any further notice or advanced notice. I don't think that very many of the aims served by this paper will really be true. I don't think that increasing density will reduce vehicular traffic. I don't think it will reduce carbon expenditures in this community. I don't know that it will improve or improve public health. I'm not sure of that. And I would tell you that I would like you very strongly to consider the plan in front of you, absent of this latest declaration today. I think, again, it creates undue hardship for us as a builder, developer.
Joel.
I just have a couple of questions. Could you tell me the exact mix of different sizes of homes? Of which?
In the affordable or in general?
In general, all of them, the whole development.
Okay. We have 34 townhomes, 17 of which are affordable. Mm-hmm. Of those 17 affordable homes, we have 7 which are 3-bedroom, 10 which are 2-bedroom. The other 17 townhomes are of comparable size. I think there's a couple different size variations within those 17 market rate.
Absolutely. And those would be probably in the vicinity of 1,500 to 2,000 square foot units, and would typically, as I understand the plan, house individual garage for each unit. We then have, and I think it is 60.
We have 66 single-family detached homes. Mm-hmm. Of those, we have 44 kind of medium-sized homes, of mm-hmm. which there is a wide range mm-hmm. of housing sizes. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Well, just give me the square footage.
Yeah, just square footage.
Just square footage.
I think that helps. The range would probably be from about 1,900 to 3,000 square feet.
Okay.
And then there are 19 homes on the eastern side.
Right, which is currently zoned RR. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those homes, because of the topography and the site conditions, will probably not be as wide as some of the home sites would allow in an effort to maintain the vegetation. But they would be probably 25 to 3,500 square feet.
Okay. And in that area, we have put in, since they are larger lots, we've actually put in building envelopes to try and preserve as much of the woods, because that is basically the nicest developable area on the property. So we want to maintain as much of the woods as we can in that RR area.
I'm done.
Okay. We'll come. Jackie.
I have two different questions. And they are, the first one is, can you please address the road issue, particularly the entrance road to Old 86?
Right.
And the second one is entirely different. That is that we are in a not very uncommon drought right now.
Mm-hmm.
As we get more and more development, we're not getting more and more water. Large reason for our, when we do run into water crises, it's lawns. It's not 10-minute showers, it's
right.
half-hour sprinklings. Mm-hmm. What, if anything, are you doing to lower the outside water usage? Now, eventually, one of my goals for the next year, and it's been a goal for a while, but this year maybe something I can have happen, is to really get low water usage mm-hmm. lawns into our zoning ordinance. I'm not doing that tonight. But are you moving at all in that direction, or what could you do?
Well, let me address your last question first.
Okay.
That's still fresh. It's in my mind. We haven't set any specific guidelines other than, if you look at the site plan, the specifically like the townhome area, there is very little lawn area. Mm-hmm. And when you get into the medium-sized homes, there's still very little lawn area. These are very small lots, roughly 6,000 square feet, with 2 to 3,000 square foot homes on them, plus, you know, the driveways, maybe again, and decks and whatnot. So there's not a lot of lawn left over on even the medium-sized lots. The larger lots, since we're trying to maintain as much of the existing vegetation as we can, inherently they don't have as much lawn as if we took these, I think they're 12 to 19, 20,000 square foot lots, there's kind of a range in there, and had 20,000 square foot lawns. We don't have that. We've got much smaller, reduced building envelopes, and we're trying to maintain as much of the natural vegetation as we can.
So would you consider in places where one would normally put grass doing something else on a couple of them just to kind of show people it can be done without being ugly?
Can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the answer to that is clearly yes. We, we eliminate the installation of lawns throughout the summer in every community in which we build. We would do that here to minimize the opportunity for people to require lawn irrigation systems. And we put the sod in or ground cover in, whatever we would choose to put in from October through April.
But you're still putting in grass that will eventually need.
Well,
need
but water. Let me get to the next point, which I think is absolutely a better answer and more direct. We would consider a lot of drought tolerant and alternative landscape programs. This is a community that, for MI Raleigh, will be a community in which we will espouse and employ quote-unquote green building techniques for the first time in MI Raleigh's corporate history, and we're excited about that. And part of that is the stewardship of water use both inside the home as well as outside. So I would tell you that, again, it's an argument for me that's counterintuitive to density. Density, increasing the density will increase the use of water, I think, throughout the communities. And if we mitigate the outside use of additional irrigation, we help.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Before we leave that topic.
Yeah. It's just a follow-up with hers. What are the homeowners' restrictions going to contain? Because if the homeowner restrictions or covenants contain, you've got to keep a lawn or vegetation in a certain way. And this is more to the board, and I guess the question to the developer. What good is it that you start out with no grass when the very opposite is contained in the homeowner's documents? Or could be contained in the homeowner's documents.
Could be. I don't think we've drafted the homeowner documents and gotten them to the point where they're anything other than thoughts in some person's minds.
Because, you know, the since we are in a community and that we are in a period in the early 21st century where you don't buy just a single home and there are no restrictive covenants of what you can and can't do in the front and in the back of your yard. You know, and I want the board to think about it in terms of what kind of, and I don't know if we can do this or not, but, you know, the developer drafts the homeowners association document. Mm-hmm. And they pass it on to the homeowners association when they reach a certain amount of individuals buying homes in that particular development. But if you continue to have such covenants, it doesn't matter what you start out.
Exactly.
So we need to be thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. But can we have a condition that stipulates that the homeowner's documents must be consistent with the green building standards that they're using?
Yeah, I'm drafting something.
Including landscaping.
Specific,
We'll come back to that.
That's just a suggestion.
Can we turn to her question about the driveway?
Yeah.
I mean, or excuse me, the entrance road.
Okay. The entrance road, basically it's on the north side of the property. It's a shared road that will be used by both the Orange County Park, which is being developed directly north of us, as well as MI Homes, as well as it connects to the collector, the north-south collector extension that runs all the way up to the school and through the park. The location that we're showing right now was basically given to us by NCDOT when they first reviewed the location. I believe the letter was dated in January of 2005, and it was included in the CUP application. It was based on the current speed limit, which is 45 miles an hour, and they told us there's a knoll just to the north of us, and they wanted us, there's an existing access easement that straddles our property and the property of Orange County Parks. That one is 400 feet from basically the peak of that road. They wanted it roughly 550 feet, so they made us shift it down the slope as far as we could without getting into that creek, which is what we are showing. We are showing also decel and turn lanes that we're improving onto our side of the road. So we hope, you know, our traffic engineer and NCDOT's guidelines say that that will help to alleviate a lot of those traffic conflicts.
Thank you.
But, and as the gentleman from the NTAAC said, we have agreed to work with them, work with town staff, and with NCDOT to see what other possibilities there are, if that speed limit can be lowered, and if so, then possibly that road could be put where the Northern Transition Area recommended.
But I think the thought is that process could take place
right. And
after.
Right, yes, and we sent out a quick memo. What we didn't want to see happen was us get held up for that. That can happen during the construction drawing phase. It can be a condition that the construction drawings can't be approved until that has been resolved. But ultimately, our position is, we have to follow NCDOT's guidelines, but we are willing to work with everybody involved and keep everybody apprised as to the situation and what kind of correspondence and that we have with NCDOT.
Thank you.
All right. Are there other questions for the applicant? All right. If not, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, you ready for something to go on the table for us to start?
I think we need
to. I have some questions for staff.
Oh, okay.
Please, if I may.
Please do.
The very simple one of which is the new summary sheet that's at our places. Jeff, can you tell me how that differs from the one that was in our packet?
This is for
Alberta.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
Project.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So
that's one major difference.
Well, it might be fun to apply some of those conditions to this and some of those to that and see what comes out at the end of the sausage grinder.
We won't get that wild. All right. Do you have other questions?
I have questions on four of the advisory board recommendations.
Okay. What page are you looking at?
I'm looking at F4. Under EAB, the recommendation of the level spreaders being added, and I guess I want to hear what the I don't know technically what a level spreader is and how that works, so
okay.
Perhaps you could explain that and why the staff doesn't agree with the EAB that that's a good idea.
This is number which, sir?
Number three,
okay,
EAB
yeah.
Three.
A level spreader is just as it sounds. It's a bit of grading. It's a bit of grading that allows water when it hits to dissipate on a level, and thereby instead of being channelized, being given sheet flow. And the DNR's standards have recently changed in that they now require a level spreader that's actually constructed out of concrete. And this is to increase their effectiveness. And so the applicant had took issue with that.
Took issue with using a concrete level spreader?
Yes, using the new standard. In reviewing NC Diener's reasons for it, I think they found that the old standard, if not maintained, could lead to, you know, it could become ineffective.
Okay, so what's in here is the new standard. Is that right? And EAB was proposing the old standard?
The EAB is proposing that the new standard be replace the current, what the applicant is providing.
Okay, and why does staff disagree with that?
Well, staff doesn't particularly disagree with that. I'm not quite sure where you make that inference.
Because it's not included as a staff recommendation.
Oh, well, I think that's a formality of the way this sheet is composed. I mean, it's
is that somewhere else and I missed it? Or?
It's in addition to the staff recommendations when going into joint review. We come to joint review with 24 recommendations, and then it's a kind of a dog pile afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And then these are EAB supplemental recommendations. So,
okay, so this is included, the level spreaders?
Well, backing up one second, historically we haven't, as staff, cast judgment one way or another on what the advisory board say, so I think Jeff's suggesting we have the staff recommendations and the advisory board ones are just standing separate of that. So we're not, for or against it. But that said, I would point out, and Henry's here, correct me if I say this wrong, Henry, but I believe that new concrete standard is actually still in draft status at NC Diener. I don't think it's officially been adopted, and Henry may be able to speak to that at more length, but I think that's one of the reasons we didn't explicitly support it. We don't typically support or for or against, but we...
Okay. Well, I consider, when the staff comes to us with, in this case, 25 recommended conditions, that what's not among those conditions is not recommended. Okay, so I apologize if that's misconstruing, but I don't see how we would know something was recommended if it's not among the recommendations. Are you saying that you think it's premature to require...
Henry's probably better suited to speak to that.
Okay.
I think that may be correct, but I'll let him say that.
Okay.
Can I ask
Henry? Is
Henry?
He's coming out right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a question. What are they talking about?
That's my question.
A little bit about level spreaders.
Thank you.
Basically, what a level spreader does is you have water that is coming down a hill or you have water that is concentrated. What a level spreader does, it captures the water, and just as the name implies, it's level across the top.
Okay.
So the water flows over the top in a sheet form, and as long as you don't have real steep slopes down below it, the water continues in a sheet flow regime as it goes onto the stream.
Oh,
now, the DWQ recently changed the design of it. DWQ in general, we look at level spreaders as devices that are capturing a big amount of water, concentrated water, spreading it out. And what we found over the years is that if you have a grass top, that a lot of times that grass gets unlevel. Gets to the point that you have a little bit of a valley forming in it, and it will tend to concentrate. Now, what we have here is a little bit different, I think. These level spreaders that they proposed to treat only yards. Some parts of the buildings are going back there, but mostly it's a yard situation. Basically, the water that's going overground, which is going to be in a diffuse or spread pattern anyway, is going down into these basins, and it was done at our request. They could have put in some other devices. They could have tried to get water other places, but this site just did not lend itself to that. So they made a good faith effort to capture all the water. And these devices, devices that they're going to be putting in are going to be grass. They'll be easily maintained. The devices with the concrete on it, it would be, if you got a 30-foot or 50-foot backyard, basically that device is going to go from one part to the other. So you're basically going to have a 50-foot dam in the back of the yard that's made out of concrete. So we felt like and still feel like that the grass type of level spreader for this type of installation is better than the concrete. It's more conducive to what it's being used for.
Will that grass erode away over time?
I don't think so, because I think here we're not talking about a big volume of water. DWQ is talking about cubic feet of water, 1, 2, 3 cubic feet of water. We're talking about maybe a tenth or 2/10 of a cubic foot of water that this thing's going to be. I mean, even if it's even if it float, if it had flowed over ground, along the ground, it's very unlikely that this water would concentrate anyway. So we're going to, so basically we're going to, I think this is, this type of design is good for this installation.
Joel.
And who would maintain that level spreader? The homeowner or the homeowners association? Or it depends on where it is. If it's in, I may have answered my own question. If it's in common area, then it'd be the homeowner association. If it's the owner of the house, it'd be there.
I'd have to let the applicant speak to that. I don't know how it's set up.
Association.
Homeowner association, regardless of whether it's physically on the lot or off the lot.
He says if it's stormwater, it's the homeowners association, whether it's on individual lot or not. Just so we have that on record. Okay. So you're sort of disagreeing with the point that the EAB is making.
I'm saying that what, not particularly disagreeing with it, I'm just saying that what they designed, I think, for the situation that it's in now, if we had a cubic foot per second of water coming to these things, then it may be that we would need something a little more stable than grass. But I think...
Well, let me ask the question a little differently. You're saying you think it may not really be necessary to do what they're suggesting in recommendation number 3, the EAB?
Yes.
Okay. I think at last I understand. Okay.
Sorry.
You could perhaps help with my next point as well, unless anyone had another question on that.
Did you want to stay on stormwater?
No, but I...
Well, this is also on stormwater.
Okay.
It's on
because I had one.
EAB number 6 is also a stormwater item, which says that the applicant should plan space for and install all stormwater detention and treatment practices so as not to infringe upon the primary conservation areas, floodplain, and stream buffers. So I'm wondering, I'm interested in staff reaction to that, or if that can be done, and if so, why it's not a good idea in this case.
Well, the stormwater treatment facilities have to go where they can capture the water, and the water is logically going to flow to the lowest point. So these devices that they have proposed are devices that will blend in well with the natural areas, with the buffer areas. The size of this development does not lend itself to having devices up in the upper part of the water, up in the upper part of the areas, to be able to get the water to it and treat it. So what they've done, they've used the lower areas where the water is flowing to, and they've put in what DWQ considers and we consider to be good detention devices and good water quality devices.
Okay, thanks. So I have 2 other questions about planning board recommendations, but if someone else had something on EAB.
Well, I had something on stormwater.
Okay, what did you say on that?
So, and Jeff, you might be able to help me with this. Number 25 is a new condition that prior to construction plan approval, the applicant either enhance or find an alternative to the storm scepters. I'm on page 6 of staff recommendations.
Agenda abstract, page 6.
Yeah.
The main item.
So I'm unclear as to what enhancements or alternatives staff had in mind. I just thought maybe that would help in my thinking. If
that's Henry's.
Okay.
Take it away.
A hydrodynamic separator is a proprietary device. It's manufactured by someone, and it is sold for use as a stormwater device. And what we found out probably a couple of months ago was that the type of the devices that were being proposed here and have been proposed on a lot of projects in actuality did not mitigate 85% of the total suspended solids. There was a test project done up in New Jersey, and it was found that they reduced only about 30 to 50%. So what this covers is that, and I think the applicant is in agreement with this, is that they will look at other types of devices that will indeed cover the 85% TSS.
All right, let's go on to the planning board.
My first question is both for staff and for the planning board chair. which is on planning board number 2, which is to use green building techniques. And I guess I want a reaction to the MI Homes memo on that, which is A, Energy Star for New Homes program, and B, the Home Builders Association for Durham Orange Chatham Green Building Initiative. Well, let me just ask James, and I guess you should come up to answer this, if that speaks to what the planning board is looking for, at least perhaps as best as we're able to in the current context.
I can't say enough about it to know one way or another. I mean, I don't know.
You're not familiar with those programs, all enough. Jeff, are we familiar with those programs? Are you or anyone in staff?
I'm trying to see where that program is referenced.
It's attachment G5, which is a memo to the Board of Aldermen from MI Homes, Ed Christensen, area president.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's specifically in regard to this stipulation.
Yeah. Well, I don't have intimate familiarity with either of these. The Energy Star program is, you know, they have a website, and they are seeking to meet certain standards. B, I have no experience with that.
Do you want to come speak? Do you want to speak to that? Is that what you're...
Come up to the microphone, if you would.
I'll just read you what I know about Energy Star. It's a national program administered by the EPA. It focuses on energy efficiency of the home. According to EPA, Energy Star homes are at least 15% more energy efficient than homes built to 2004 International Residential Code, IRC. Energy Star label has broad consumer recognition and acceptance. It also has a third-party independent testing to verify that our homes comply with that energy savings. The HBA of Durham, Orange, and Chatham counties has established a green building initiative. The National Association of Home Builders Green Building Program is our parent, sort of the umbrella arm of the Home Builders Association for the country, implemented locally by the Durham, Orange, and Chatham County HBA. The program includes standards that not only address energy efficiency, but address comfort, durability of the home, expand beyond Energy Star, and the environments for living to address indoor air quality, water usage, material selection, and environmental impact of the home on the site in which it is built. Members of this HBA can participate in the program, and we will, to earn a certification to satisfy their requirements for a Green Building Initiative certified home.
Thanks. And if you could stay up for a minute, because you can probably answer my next question. First of all, I want to commend you all for, you know, following what I think are some probably good, pretty good industry standards, not that anyone else in the room knows a lot about them, but and clearly, you know, as a town, we need to take our own look at some of these issues in terms of developing a sense of our own expectations. But I think lacking that, you know, you are responding to the concern, and that's appreciated. Planning Board Recommendation 1 for a neighborhood composting unit. Did you all consider that? And what was
I believe we have agreed.
You have?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks. All right.
Thank you. Randy, did you have anything else?
No.
Okay.
Not answered.
If there's no one else, I think it's appropriate to move to close the public hearing. If
so, move.
Second.
It's been moved in.
Just one thing.
Sorry, Jeff.
Right
I
after
just,
Jeff tells us this.
I just wanted to give you some reference. Late changes, condition 3 and condition 25, the applicant requested some small changes. They're not substantial so much. They just broaden the conditions slightly. And I'll just leave these up here, and you can cross-reference as you go through.
Okay.
And then there's a possible new condition regarding, at the bottom, regarding the discussion you had with Jay Bryan and the issue with the driveway location. And then, as a reminder, in these conditions, the strikeouts are the former. Number one is revised, basically, to reserve the last 17 market rate units, to reserve COs on those, and not issue those until all the affordable units are issued. Condition number two is revised to address Robert Dowling's concern. And in regard to that, condition number two assumes that, doesn't necessarily assume, but if Mr. Dowling's organization cannot sell the home, that it goes back to the applicant and under the ordinance that it was substantially developed under, which is prior to the new one that was adopted. So I just want to clarify that.
Does that include the potential of the pro rata sales as opposed to the waiting to the end condition?
I think number one.
It's not a pro rata approach, but it does mean they can't wait till the end to build the affordable units.
That is a standard condition that we typically done.
Okay. One question I forgot to ask.
Sure.
Is there any issue about, like number 24, will there be any issue with there getting enough caps to build the project?
I don't believe there will. I'm not certain if we haven't gotten a Scroggs letter at this point. He's reviewed the plans, so it's in their sites. I don't believe we've received the caps issuance yet, though.
It's a minor point until it becomes a major point. So just kind of wanted to know if it was.
Yeah.
But just sort of a follow-up.
The whole thing stops.
Yeah,
it's the bottom line.
That's what I meant.
Right, until they have enough space. So that's what I know.
Right.
Of course, now they are building an elementary school out there.
Right.
And they bought and purchased land for a middle school. And they just opened up a new high school. They may be able to fit in.
I guess we'll see.
We'll just see.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. So there's been moved and seconded that we close the public hearing. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Can you leave that up just for reference so that when we get there?
Yeah.
So you guys want to start working through this?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'll move the application is complete.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. The application is complete. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. The matter passes unanimously.
I'll move that the application is in compliance with the land use ordinance.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 And here we get to the fun part. And just for purposes of discussion, I will move consideration, or basically I'll move conditions, staff conditions 1 through 24 as revised number 1. Revised number 2, which references attachment E, which is Robert's letter describing basically the process they're going to go through in cooperation with Robert. Revised number 3, and add number 25. And add the possible new conditions 26
for the driveway
access road
location.
Can
flexibility.
Is this where we ask for additional ones, or do we just approve these and ask for additional?
Was there anyone want to tinker with these that are on the table?
No, I think these are fine. And particularly the possible new condition. I think that could go a long way in addressing that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded that we use the various revised recommendations plus number 25 up there, new condition, and also
new 26
regarding the access road. Are there any proposed amendments to that motion?
My only proposed amendment to that motion is the one that I had brought up about the homeowner's documents.
I've got some language drafted for that.
Okay. Let's hear that.
I was thinking of doing these in two separate motions because we still have to then approve the, at the end of the game, we have to approve the permit subject to all the conditions that have agreed to. So if we can just get a vote on this package, and then we can add that stuff.
I understand.
Is that cool, Mark? Can you
Do
with that?
Yeah.
That works for
Does that make sense, Mr. Attorney? All right. So it's been moved and seconded that, that among others, we require the 26 conditions that were outlined. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, I pass unanimously. All right, now,
okay, are there further conditions?
I would, whatever that language that you were proposing.
Well, let me try this on precise. See if this gets
Alex
addressing the
not necessarily.
No, let me see if this gets at what you were getting at. Dan had a, sounds like he was sort of gestating something that was a little broader. This is more specific. Another condition would be 27. Thank you. I can't count anymore. The Homeowners Association document should contain no language requiring or encouraging lawn and landscaping techniques. Let me add and species. Encouraging or requiring regular water usage and encouraging landscaping design and fauna requiring no irrigation or water usage.
Can you reverse those?
Sure.
Reverse.
Joe, does that get to what you were getting at?
Right.
Read it again.
Okay.
He's got a reverse.
I think it probably reads better reversed. You're right.
Okay.
See, I need to hire me an editor here. Okay. Homeowners Association documents.
Pay for that, Alex.
You got 2 months, gang. Homeowners Association documents should contain language encouraging landscaping design and fauna requiring no irrigation or water usage. That's number one.
Right.
Let me break this into number one and number two.
Okay.
And two, Homeowners Association documents should contain no language requiring or encouraging lawn and landscaping techniques or species encouraging or requiring regular water usage.
That encourages.
Does that work?
Yeah.
That encourages.
That encourages.
Or which encourages.
Or which
encourages. Which encourages.
The other thing is that you mean flora and not fauna, but...
What about there shooting all the birds?
What? You mean flora, not fauna.
Oh, crap. I was getting backwards.
That's okay.
Thank you very much,
Kingdom.
But I appreciate it.
Okay, otherwise.
The walking Wikipedia speaks. All right.
Thank you, Alex.
Does that work?
I have a question for you all, really, and maybe for Mike. The use of or the installation of underground irrigation systems, is that something that's that can be in a covenant if we ask for that not to be permissible?
To sort of specifically disallow them, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'd have to ask for the applicant's reaction to that, I think.
Well, what my
why
answer,
we ask
I don't
for
know.
I mean,
it's a condition. Well, it's reasonable. His question is a reasonable condition. I guess the hesitancy that I have is twofold. One, if that's going to be a change in policy, it might be something you wish to address by ordinance as opposed to a sort of a condition that's getting imposed on some places and not others. And two, the enforcement of that is going to be, I mean, if you have it in the covenants or in a condition.
This is a condition...
I
think we should leave it alone, and hopefully very soon we're going to come up with a water-saving ordinance for landscaping that really has some.
So we shouldn't put it in as a condition.
But I'd like to also
not the irrigation.
Oh, okay.
Everything
irrigation
else, but not
okay,
the irrigation.
I can live
with I'd like to also, I mean, just to note for later reflection. I mean, I think there are other areas of environmental concern that pertain to possible HOA regulations like clotheslines or solar access, those kinds of things.
I agree with
that. We also should address in our later discussion.
In a larger context.
Yeah.
Paint color.
Right.
Yeah, but if you don't like clotheslines, that means they got to use dryers. How environmentally responsible is that?
No, but he's saying he wants
so that it wouldn't be against the
government. Anyway, sorry, I was assuming
that's
something.
Task.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. So,
all right, kids. Are we happy with that language?
Yes.
I'll second that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's the flora only, not the...
not the fauna.
No, no, but I mean not the... We're not addressing the question of underground sprinkler systems.
Right, right. Okay.
No, correct. Bambi can drink water if she happens to walk through.
All right. Okay.
So can the cat.
So that's one. Are we going to do the, are we going to vote on these things individually?
Unless anybody's got anything to add, why don't we just add some more and then we'll just do those as
a pack. Okay, so and that's so number 27.
That's number 27.
Right. Or
that's 27.
Proposed number 27. Yeah. What else? Right. Did you have anything you wanted to, out of that?
We got the book.
EAB or planning
what
more
about
stuff?
The the composting unit was,
That was agreed to.
That was
okay.
Agreed to.
Okay.
All right, we got to go, boys and girls. Okay, and well, so the application is complete.
But let's vote on. Let's vote to add number 27.
Okay. Move we add number 27.
And it was seconded.
Second.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Okay.
Okay. Move the application is granted, subject to the conditions agreed upon under Section 3, which we just voted on.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor, signify by
saying
aye.
I'd like to make a comment before I vote, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
Because I am going to vote for this, but I'm doing it with some reluctance because I agree with the planning board that this is not dense enough, but I'd actually go beyond that a little bit, that it's either not dense enough or it's too dense, depending on what we think we want to do there, and that we're caught in this moment in time where we're about to update the Northern Study Area, and it's really too bad that we're having to make commitments to these properties at this time. But I think what the applicant said about the several years of good faith work they've done with the staff and all that, you know, I couldn't in good conscience deny them on that basis at this time. But I think it's important to acknowledge that that we need to be developing differently, and we all know that, and we're going to. I also want to make the point that I'm glad that we've updated our affordable housing regulations for the future, because this level of subsidy is just really troublesome and makes it more difficult to ultimately reach our goals for affordable housing. So thank you for indulging me.
All right. Go ahead.
4 sentences. And I just have to give this lecture. One reason people like to develop here is because they make money. There are 3 schools that have been built or will be built in this area within the next 24 months. In our little part of Orange County, the average house price increases 8.2%. While we realize it is a difficult task to develop in this little part of southern Orange County, at the end of the day, people like living here. And I understand you spend $1 million, but you're going to make more than $1 million. And I'm going to vote for it.
Okay. That was the last sentence was fairly compound. But
I like long compound sentences.
All right. I just have one real quick to add. Hey, I'm not even running for nothing.
So then I probably shouldn't let you, but go ahead.
Yeah. And then we're going to start charging everybody for time. Actually, I agree philosophically with what the planning board put forward. I think it is also worth noting that we had a recommendation from the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee in direct conflict with that. And that's what my inclination was, just to leave that issue alone for right now. And I think, as Dan pointed out, that's better off addressed as an overall policy matter. I think by and large, though, looking at the application, these folks have largely complied not just with the land use ordinance, but with the Northern Study Area plan that is currently in place. And obviously, people are talking about taking some further steps in that direction. So, you know, I think a little credit where credit is due. Okay. And I'm done.
You know, the fact that there are any townhouses at all is something in terms of something a little different than a lot of what we see. Anyway, all right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. All right, well, somebody in the next 2 months is going to have to learn how to do this besides Alex.
Yeah, we're working on it.
I may work as a consulting parliamentarian for $200 an hour.
Too much.
We'll have to get back to you about that. Item C3, public hearing on a request to permanently close a section of the Center Street right-of-way.
And, Mac, this won't take as long as the other one did.
The purpose of this agenda item is to hold a public hearing on a request to permanently close a section of Center Street right-of-way adjacent to 203 Center Street.
Does the board want to hear a staff report on this, or are you satisfied with the paper record on this?
Yeah, this is
satisfied.
Is there anyone here who would like to speak on this matter? Hearing none.
Move public hearing to close.
Second.
Move second to close. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Second.
Move the request to be granted.
George is looking really disappointed.
Second, George.
Move and seconded to grant the request and close the right away. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Let's take
that passed unanimously. George, as always, outstanding piece of work.
Yay, George.
We're going to take a seven-minute break.
I just want to say, Jeff, look how quickly George can move through public hearings.
Yes.
So,
what's your problem, Jeff?
All he's got to do is
do that. He's got a damn.
I've been consistent about it.
All right. Welcome back. We are on item C4 on our agenda tonight. If you could hold it down in the audience, please. We're on item C4, and we're actually also going to conducting a hearing at the same time on the request for a minor modification of the conditional use permit for Carmel Mall. This public hearing, the main public hearing here, is on the Alberta Mixed Use Building CUP and rezoning application.
Just one minor correction. The minor modification is not a public hearing.
Okay.
We'll be receiving comments at the same time with this item. Okay. Carmel Investment Limited Partnership and NR Million Associates, on behalf of the partnership, have submitted applications for B1G conditional use rezoning and a conditional use permit to allow for the construction of a four-story mixed-use building at 100 Sweet Bay Place / 300 Roberson Street on the site where the farmer's market was once held. The Board of Aldermen is scheduled to hold a public hearing on the rezoning request permit application on Tuesday, August 28th. It is necessary for the Board to receive public comment before taking action on this item, and I would remind the Board that there, in addition to the minor modification, there are two other issues, both the rezoning and the CUP. So Trish is going to cover the rezoning portion, and then I believe Marty is doing the CUP piece, so a little different than normal. Trish.
That's right. Thanks very much. Good evening, everyone. The item before you is, well, actually, Steve just covered the point that these hearings are held simultaneously for the conditional use rezoning and the conditional use permit. The hearing is conducted following the procedures that apply to conditional use permits in its entirety, so it is a quasi-judicial proceeding. The public hearing is going to provide an opportunity for you all to review the applications and consider them, and for the public to provide comments in relation to the request before you. The request that you have in front of you is from the Carmel Investment Limited Partnership. They are the applicant and owner of the property, which consists of a little over 2 acres of land in downtown Carborough, right at the corner of Sweet Bay Place and Roberson Street. And the request is to rezone that property from its current zoning, which is split approximately one-third in the B1G zoning district and two-thirds in the B2 zoning district, to the entire parcel zoned B1G conditional use. So this is the location of the property here, the corner of Roberson and Sweet Bay Place. The zoning district line is right about in that location, so this top piece is B1G currently, and the lower portion is B2. Why is this a conditional use rezoning? Why is there a conditional use rezoning request in front of you for this property? This allows the property to achieve consistent zoning over the entire lot. It will allow the residential density on the site to be increased from approximately 16 to 30 dwelling units. The B2 zoning district has a residential density of about 7,500 square feet per dwelling unit, and the B1G has a residential density of 3,000 square feet per dwelling unit. By counting the entire lot as B1G, they increase that residential density. Of the permitted uses in the B1G zoning district that are requested, one of those is not currently allowed in the B2 zoning district, and that is the high-volume retail use. Although the development on this site is occurring within what is the current confines of the B1G zoning district, we are treating the parcel as a whole in this request, and so those uses would be applicable throughout in terms of parking associated with a particular use and so forth. A conditional use zoning district proposal allows full consideration of all the details of a development plan. That would not be possible under a standard rezoning if the applicant were to come in and just ask for the property to be rezoned to B1G. Because of the small size of this lot, they would not be able to reveal any of the specifics of their proposal. And so the neighbors and the community and the town would be considering the appropriateness of the entirety of this lot for the rezoning and all of the uses that could occur in the B1G. This allows us to focus on the details of their site plan. The board, in this combination action of a rezoning, conditional use rezoning and conditional use permit, does have broader authority than in a standard quasi-judicial proceeding, in that the legislative decision is part of the action that you will be considering tonight or at a future date following as part of this hearing. And the conditional use district rezoning requires that all the uses that would be proposed on the site be approved through the conditional use permit process. And so there's greater scrutiny of the development that occurs in the town. The evaluation of a conditional use rezoning is guided by provisions in the land use ordinance. Three different sections apply. Of course, the reports and site plans and other information that are provided in advance of the public hearing and things that you hear tonight. And then the broad question of a rezoning as to whether or not this this proposed change in the zoning designation for the property is consistent with the community's health, safety, or welfare. The first section is the zoning district provision of the land use ordinance that spells out conditional use districts, and it requires that the request for conditional use rezoning be initiated by the owners of the property, that the uses that are proposed be permissible within the requested conditional use district, in this case the B1G conditional use district, that the development application show the details of how the entirety of the site will be used, and that you simultaneously hold a public, that is to say that there is simultaneous review of the rezoning application and the conditional use permit application, and a public hearing. Public hearings are conducted simultaneously on this question. Section 15.324 of the ordinance deals with the procedural requirements associated with making decisions on rezonings. There is no required time frame for your decision, although the board is encouraged to act not quickly but reasonably, since delays in decisions like this can result in additional costs to an applicant. The board is required to adopt a statement that explains whether its action is consistent with an adopted plan, and then how the action is believed to be reasonable and in the public interest. And these are required findings associated with a change in an amendment to either the zoning ordinance, the land use ordinance, or the map, as we have in front of us tonight. And then the other section in this, or item in this particular section, notes that members of the Board of Aldermen may not vote where the outcome of a zoning amendment is likely to have a direct, substantial, or readily identifiable financial impact on them. The other section that is relevant to a rezoning decision is the general question of whether or not the proposal advances the public health, safety, or welfare. And that really is, in our land use ordinance, the key issue before the board. Other issues are considered to be irrelevant, and they can be dismissed as items that are not up for discussion if the mayor chooses to do that in the course of the conduct of the public hearing. Of course, in this case, you will be talking about the specifics of a site plan, and so I think that there are some, there is certainly provisions to talk about all the details of that. The relevant plans and policies that apply in the downtown and to this rezoning are the Roberson Street right-of-way plan, a plan for the for improvements within the right-of-way, or an additional right-of-way for that street that you all adopted just subsequent to the approval of the prior CUP on this property for the old farmers market office building. There's going to be further discussion of that in the CUP presentation on this in just a few minutes. And then the town's policy documents, policy document, particularly Carver Revision 2020. A few highlights are noted in your report and here in that that it seemed to be relevant to this proposal, and that is recommendation regarding balanced and controlled growth, particularly related to providing diversity of housing stock. This project does add new downtown residential units, something that is not really present in the downtown currently, and they are both proposed to be both market rate and affordable units. The Carver Vision 2020 also spells out development goals for the downtown related to increased commercial square footage, increased density of commercial development, improvements to the infrastructure of the downtown, and transit and traffic initiatives to support more of a multimodal transportation system. Additionally, those policies call for a variety of residential units to be provided in the downtown, particularly as part of a mixed-use development. And this project does include both retail and office uses in addition to retail, in addition to residential. The applicant has also provided for you a narrative on the appropriateness of this rezoning request in relation to in relation to the policies of the downtown and the desired growth there. And is here tonight, of course, to provide some additional comments or respond to questions from you about those that narrative. Briefly, the findings that we've noted regarding the appropriateness of this rezoning request are that principally, or first foremost, the ordinance and policies do support the use of a conditional use district as a means of providing greater transparency in a proposal, but also the opportunity to consider a development action in relation to a number of different policies that the town is seeking to advance. The developed square footage and intensity are intensified with or increased by this proposal. The conditional use rezoning provides an open forum for consideration of the and mitigation of possible impacts of changes in zoning and increased intensification rather of development in the downtown. The combined legislative and quasi-judicial action affords the Board of Aldermen the opportunity to consider this action specifically in relation to both the provisions of the land use ordinance and then other broader questions about the town's the direction the town is seeking to go in. The property is suited for the B1G conditional use rezoning, specifically in this case because of the site plan that is in front of you, because the current proposal does intensify the development on the B1G portion of the site. It leaves the B2's portion of the site relatively unchanged, the portion of the site that is most adjacent to surrounding residential neighborhoods. And yet the new building will provide residential opportunities, business opportunities, and will involve the provision of some additional urban amenities and infrastructure improvements in the downtown. There is one other policy in Vision 2020, and of course there are a number of things there that peripherally may be related, but that document also calls for the development of underutilized properties in the downtown, and this does seem to be an example of that as well. The application for the rezoning and the conditional use permit was submitted to the advisory boards earlier this month, and the Appearance Commission, the EAB, Transportation Advisory Board, the Planning Board, and the Economic Sustainability Commission have supported the proposal. They do have a variety of comments and conditions that have been noted in their recommendation statements, as well as summarized in the staff's report related to this project. The CU rezoning, from the staff's perspective, has been found to be consistent with adopted plans and policy, and also to advance, from the staff's position, the public health, safety, and welfare. And our recommendation with regard to the rezoning is approval subject to the conditions that are identified in the presentation that will follow regarding the CUP application. Happy to try and answer any questions.
Are there questions about the rezoning specifically at this point? We can obviously come back to it in a little bit, but if there's something.
Let me just go ahead and ask so I can know, as my question I asked prematurely earlier about the difference between the summary sheets. I noticed that the new one has the point of discussions enumerated. Is that the only difference between the two? Or?
That's that, and also number 8 is rewritten. Those actually. Okay, let me be clear. Number 8 is rewritten. The Roberson Street point, I don't know how closely you have scrutinized the one you received in the mail, but the Roberson Street point of discussion has been removed from the one that was handed out tonight because it was
changed into a CUP, a staff recommended CUP condition, and I just simply forgot to delete it from the point of discussion when I did that. And I inadvertently deleted from the one that I handed out tonight the screening flexibility one, which was in the package you received in the mail. Have I thoroughly confused you?
No, that's clear.
Okay.
All right. Sticking on the rezoning issues for just a moment, I want to make sure I understood your first slide. Can you just click back to that? The first slide. Forward a little bit. There we go. On that second bullet, high volume retail allowed, but are you saying that? I just want to be clear. You're saying so. Is it at this point clear that high volume retail uses would be included in this particular proposed development?
They do have listed high volume retail as one of their requested uses within the building. Yes.
Okay.
Proposed uses. Marty or Jack Haggerty can provide the details on this specific.
Okay.
That is not allowed as a use in the B2 zoning district currently, only in the B1G.
Okay. That's all I had a question on. And Marty, you have a presentation on the development plan. All right. Well, why don't you come up and give us that? And then we're going to hear from the applicant, and then we'll hear from the public.
Good evening, everybody. I'll jump right in, and it's been a somewhat long night already, so I'll try and get through this relatively quickly. The Alberta CUP, you already know the project and the site. Some basic information. Before I go there, let me go to here. For perhaps people in the audience, I'm sure the board is familiar, but this is an aerial photo of the site. Right here we see the green. The building would be located up on the north end of the lot. Just to back up, I may be repeating Trish to some degree here, so let me go through it quickly. It's a 2+, a little over 2 acres in size. It splits this. I'm not sure if Trish really touched on this. It splits, as proposed, it would split the Carmel complex from this lot. Currently, there's one CUP governing both pieces of property, and this would effectively leave the Carmel complex under one CUP and create a new CU rezone, new zoning district, and CUP for this particular piece of property. I think you've already heard, four-story mixed-use building, residential density of 23 units. They could have a total of 45 if they maximized what the B1G zoning district would allow with a density bonus, but 23 is what is proposed, along with approximately 6,700 square feet of commercial space, a mix of uses, retail, office, and restaurant. 69 spaces are required.
Yes, sir. I'm curious why, under the evaluation in our packet, on attachment A4, it said it had 16,000 square feet. Was that an error in this document then?
Was that retail? What commercial space you mean?
Well, it's under double commercial square footage in the downtown, and then it says in that bullet under 3.21, this project, A4.
Okay.
Is this yes. Part 1, A4?
Yes.
That's Trish.
It is. So the 16,000 is wrong. The 6,000.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It's 6,700.
Okay.
Correct.
Go ahead, Mark.
Okay. 69 spaces required and 69 are provided. That's through flexible parking. Let me explain. It's not flexible in that you're being asked to approve a reduction in the parking required. There's a estimated chart that estimates how much retail versus office versus restaurant will actually occur in the building. So I've mentioned this to you in past projects. That may fluctuate some. If it fluctuated greatly from what's shown on the plans, the town could
call them on it and have a discussion with them about that. But generally, there's some fluctuation allowed in the amount of retail versus office versus restaurant. Recreation points, excuse me, I skipped one. Recreation points are met entirely by an interior exercise room, and I may touch on that very briefly later. The one I skipped was a shared parking arrangement. I mentioned a moment ago that this formally splits the Carmel complex from this piece of property, but they would have as a CUP condition, and as I understand from talking to the property manager, they've actually already recorded a formal agreement that essentially binds these two properties together, even though they're two separate properties under permit for purposes of parking, which is to say you can park at either site for either building. Moving on now to the site plan. Let me grab the laser. Just walk you through here briefly. Roberson Street is on the north end of the top of what you're looking at. Sweet Bay Place is going north and north to south. And the proposed building, as I mentioned earlier, be located right at the top, the north end of the property. Carr Street comes into the property here, existing situation, and they're effectively creating a driveway behind the building that would connect Carr Street with Sweet Bay. We did have a fair amount of discussion at the staff level leading up to tonight about whether that potentially should be a public street, and the applicant desired strongly to keep it private, and in the end, we basically agreed that we could recommend approval with it being a private street. So effectively, it would act as a connection between Sweet Bay and Carr Street, but it would be private. Sidewalks on the north side of the building and the east side of the building. You see here on the east, there's a little loading zone intended for UPS trucks and quick delivery drop-off situations. So the sidewalk kind of cuts in towards the building here and then back out. And there's also an 8-foot sidewalk on the back side of the building. I'll talk a little more detail in a minute or two here about Roberson Street, but just quickly, that is a greater than 10-foot width sidewalk. It is also greater than 10-foot on the north side here, but as you get to this loading zone, it narrows down to about 8 feet. And again, it's 8 feet on the back side. Solid waste facilities are located right here, kind of in the middle of the parking lot. I didn't mention yet, but very briefly say, late 2002 or sometime in 2002, the same applicant had an application before the board for a three-story all-commercial building, did actually receive a CUP, but the building was never actually constructed. There was a good amount of discussion during that public hearing about the dumpster facility, and there was an arrangement ultimately to put it to have a shared arrangement with the EMS building next door. This time they've chosen to put it right kind of in the middle of the parking. Just a brief history there. The parking area, let me jump forward to this slide. The parking area where they've essentially identified 69 spaces is right behind the building and off towards Maple Avenue. Again, this, as everyone here probably knows, it is an existing parking lot, so essentially they've identified 69 spaces that would be dedicated to this building. I don't think they necessarily have intentions of rigidly enforcing that, but for purposes of going through our review process, they identified 69 and said these will be the parking spaces for this building. Of note, they are proposing a gate right here, and correct me on the number here, Jack, if I get it wrong, there's approximately 30 spaces that would be, I guess you would say, rigidly enforced by gate. You would have to have a key or some type of access pass to get into that specific area. And I don't really know in any detail. They may be able to tell you in more detail who those spaces would be reserved for, whether it's the residential units or some amount for the commercial or what. Downtown livability and urban livability, this is a relatively new section in the ordinance. They've identified over here the hatched areas as a downtown livability area, essentially open space. This is, everyone's probably familiar, or most people are familiar with the tree border on this site, counts as downtown livability area. And over here on the left, we have a chart. It's probably kind of difficult to read in the back. All the areas identified by hatched area over here total 16,552 square feet.
thereby exceeding the downtown livability requirement. And then for urban amenities, there's a variety of features proposed, planted areas wider than required sidewalks, a bronze historical plaque, and a few other things totaling $43,935 and some change, whereas the requirement was $42,000. So they've also exceeded that. Stormwater, I'll just mention briefly, they are the overall amount of impervious surface on the site is being reduced, so they aren't held in the same manner that some projects would be to our typical water quality requirements. There's kind of a presumed improvement in water quality with less impervious surface on the site as a whole. There are a couple of issues that the town engineer and the consulting engineer are working out, and that's represented by what I mentioned earlier, rewritten number 8, condition number 8. And the appearance commission, a couple of more things to mention, and I'll move on to a conclusion here. Appearance commission has met on a couple of occasions to discuss this project, most recently, two or three weeks ago, I don't recall exactly when it was. In discussing with the town attorney, they technically didn't have a quorum that night. So there's a condition about that related to the downtown design standards, the required architectural standards. Everything I've heard from the appearance commission has been entirely positive, so I expect that won't be a big deal, but I wanted to explain that condition in case you noted it. It's an unusual condition. Burden of proof, we've had a couple of these projects before us now. Just to remind you quickly, this building exceeds 2 stories in the downtown zoning district. Therefore, the burden of proof related to public health, safety, and welfare is on the applicant versus the town. And they have provided, as an attachment in your package, a letter from a certified real estate appraiser suggesting that the project will improve property values. Nonconforming situations to remain. On this site, there are existing light poles that are higher than the current maximum height of 15 feet. They've actually shown us through concentric foot candle information that they do comply with our light intensity standards, but the height of the poles is too high, so that's something that they're requesting be allowed to remain in place. Quickly flipping to the Carmel minor modification, I don't have much to tell you about that, except it is kind of a necessary piece of this puzzle if you choose to approve this project. The only thing that you're really asked to decide on related to the Carmel site is, again, nonconforming situations to remain. The two situations there, again, is the height of the light poles and width of sidewalks. Sidewalks currently are required to be 10 feet in this area of town. And I mentioned a 15-foot height limit on the lights. So related to the minor modification, that's really about all I have to say. I can certainly talk more about that piece of the puzzle if you'd like, but I'm really focusing on the piece in front of you right now. Moving on to a couple more slides. And then I will be done. Identified as a point of discussion, and I know Trish pointed this out, that there's some room for discussion, if you so choose, related to right-of-ways and sidewalks and such. The points of discussion are identified in the report, and I'm just going to basically visually show you a couple of the issues before us. Let me grab the laser. They're currently, as I mentioned earlier, proposing a sidewalk in this location along Sweet Bay, and the question is whether they would dedicate right-of-way. The staff asked during the review process if they would do that, and they declined to do so, but I believe are willing to discuss that further with you tonight. I don't want to speak for them, but I believe they are. What you see in red here, the outside edge is the existing property line. And as you can see, basically all of that sidewalk would effectively be on private property. Down to the south end of the building where the driveway would be. From that point, continuing south, the staff essentially is bringing before you, if you so choose to discuss with the applicant and owner, possible right-of-way dedication for future construction of a sidewalk. The staff had kind of started this at the advisory board level by floating the possibility of whether they should actually be building a sidewalk, and there didn't seem to be much support. This is getting, I shouldn't back up, Dan, entirely to a project, but as I said, we don't typically come to you judging what the advisory board said, but we did kind of float that in front of the advisory boards, and there wasn't much support for actually constructing the sidewalk all the way down. As you can see, there's a lot of trees, some existing, some proposed, that would have to be removed, likely would have to be removed to build a sidewalk there. So essentially, we backed off of sidewalk construction and just suggested right-of-way dedication. Flipping to Roberson Street, and I apologize, this one slide is flipped 90 degrees, so Roberson Street, the north end, is down at the bottom of this slide. The same situation, as you see here, the sidewalk from the edge of the building all the way out to the street, approximately 14 foot in width. The existing property line is right here, so again, it effectively would be a private sidewalk as proposed. Roberson Street, we do have, as Trish discussed, an adopted plan, the Roberson Street right-of-way plan, and this was another issue that we had taken to the advisory board, and ultimately, upon bringing it to you, have a recommended condition rather than just a point of discussion. The issue, briefly, is that what you see here, this dashed line, is the existing edge of pavement on Roberson Street. The swath of pavement in Roberson Street is not centered within the right-of-way. So if you implemented, as a part of this project, the Roberson Street right-of-way plan as adopted, it would go out to the center line and you would end up with a deficient travel lane on the north end. It would be less than ideal for a car to get through there. So what we're recommending is that they install the five-foot planting strip, basically that they comply with the plan, install the five-foot planting strip, install an eight-foot wide on-street parking area, and then have two travel lanes. So in effect, they are complying with the Roberson Street plan, but we recognize as a staff and would ask that you consider that it's not necessarily realistic that this will be formally used as an on-street parking area in the immediate future, because to park a car here, you would end up with this deficient travel lane on the north end. Hopefully that makes sense. I can talk about it further if necessary. Architecture, I won't say much about. The architect certainly is here, and I'll allow him to expound on this. As mentioned, though, it's a four-story building, lots of windows, and glazing on the commercial side, though they did, as I mentioned earlier, have to go to the Appearance Commission for a couple of reasons, glazing among them, because they didn't technically meet the recently adopted downtown design standards. And then I just have the floor plans for reference in case you'd like to see that, and then the conditions. With that, I just mention if you choose to act tonight, I have kind of a recommended, upon discussing with the attorney earlier today, a recommended order of actions, and that would be consideration of the minor modification first, the rezoning second, and the CUP third. With that, happy to answer questions.
Before you get the question, just for sequencing, that's probably the way in which you'd want to act on them, but I think in terms of discussion, you want to discuss them all, and because clearly you would not want to grant the rezoning and then deny other of the second or the third ones. So it's kind of, I think the discussion ought to be sort of in total of the project, and then if you're comfortable with saying, okay, we're going to approve this project, then they probably don't. Sequencing of approvals would be as suggested, the permit, the rezoning, and then, I'm sorry, the modification of the permit, the rezoning, and then the issuance of the permit.
Okay.
Thank you. Joel.
Okay, I got a couple of questions. With the addition of the, or the sort of limitation of the could you stop at the parking?
Parking. Sure.
Right. Then there would be how many spaces left that this building and the building across the street would share? Do you know?
Jack, can you help me out with those numbers?
So that would remain after taking those out of the...
Can you... Come,
well, hold on. Can both you guys just come up and get sworn real quick?
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's okay.
But I've got the number.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm the evidence you're about to give the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
After satisfying the need of the mall and this building, there's about 70 vacant parking spaces.
Okay. And that's for daytime and nighttime, too?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, my next question is for staff. I thought, and this may be just not remembering correctly, do we not have a policy regarding public and private streets?
You mean whether a street should be
right.
dedicated to the public?
Yes.
We certainly, well, we do. We have ordinance, as a matter of fact, related to that. And in many residential subdivision situations, it is what I hope I'm not exaggerating, I call an absolute requirement related to ordinance language in many residential subdivision situations. In a commercial project such as this where there's no subdivision of land involved, the board certainly still has that authority to require a public road. I believe I'm not misspeaking or overstating the situation, but it's not an absolute requirement as it sometimes is in residential subdivisions.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Yeah, but I have a couple more questions, but go ahead.
So in terms of this driveway, what is it, in fact, other than in language, that makes it a driveway rather than a continuation of the road? That was unclear to me from the drawing.
Well, it's not the right-of-way width is not in place. The width of the travel lanes, effectively two-way traffic, is virtually the same as a public road, and barring some kind of gate being put up or otherwise restricting the flow of traffic there, it would be a passable stretch of asphalt, in effect, a public road. But the right-of-way width is certainly not present. The sidewalk requirement would have gone from 8 feet to 10 feet and may have been in, well, I wouldn't say it's, again, not an absolute requirement that you would have to have a 10-foot sidewalk on both sides of it, but the sidewalk standards would be different also.
Given that there's no reason not to expect that the public wouldn't use that driveway as a cut-through, did the staff have any opinion as to the safety of that being established as a private driveway as opposed to a public road?
Not with respect to this particular application. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here. I don't think I am. The staff came at this kind of looking at a bigger picture, and there's a lot of development potentially taking place in the downtown, and approached the applicant to at least discuss the possibility that it might benefit the town as a whole to have a public road connection in that spot. But with respect to this particular application and with respect to the CUP aspect of it, there's not a volume of traffic associated with this individual project that would, you know, make us have a strong opinion that it should be a public road. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, thanks, for now.
The construction standards would be different, too, in terms of if it was a public street, the pavement's got to be a lot thicker.
There may be some, at least minor differences there. Yes, you're correct.
But the main one, the maintenance responsibility would be on them.
Yes.
If it's private. Sorry. Back to you, Phil.
My next question is regarding the no size limited unit may be enlarged for 1 year after issuance of a certificate of occupancy. And I guess as I look at this building, I'm thinking the only way you could make a larger... You'd have to buy the smaller one and combine it with a larger...
Exactly.
Okay.
I almost didn't include that condition, and then it occurred to me that someone potentially could do that.
And I think... refresh my memory. Is there a sidewalk on the other side?
Of Sweet Bay?
Yeah. You mean?
Yes, there is.
Okay. That's what I thought. That's all my questions for now. I got some comments about private roads, but I'll hold on to that when we discuss the whole thing.
Jackie and then Dan.
Is there a construction management, construction traffic impact management plan for this and good neighbor policies? Or right up front, like a major concern that I'm sure you'll hear about in a couple minutes is it's not a good idea to have construction traffic going up and down Carr Street. Has that been addressed?
Yes, ma'am. I meant to address that during my presentation. Attachment M, we have, I guess going back to just before the summer break and some comments from the board, we've been asking the applicant to proactively address that and basically have put before the applicant for all the downtown projects we're currently reviewing comments received from the board in early June, I think it was, and attachment M represents their reaction.
Okay.
I am buried in paper right here. Could you please just kind of tell me what that is?
Sure, I'll paraphrase. We propose surrounding the building and staging area, and they have an attached drawing, with a 6-foot high opaque fence. Customers and employees of the mall will use East Carr Street, which connects to Maple Avenue, Roberson, and South Greensboro for ingress and egress to the parking lot. The spaces provided exceed the required amount of parking. Construction parking will, and this is what you're getting at, I believe, construction parking versus the first part of what I just mentioned would be employees of Carmel Mall. Construction parking will use the existing means of ingress and egress from Roberson Street as the building rises. Construction traffic will use the construction entrance off Sweet Bay Lane, which will become permanent. Near completion of construction, a portion of the parking lot closest to Maple Avenue will be closed off for installation of the gates for condominium parking. Mall patrons and employees will use the new drive access from Sweet Bay. They anticipate starting in first quarter of 2008, and it would take approximately 1 year.
But that's... These are some good points of discussion, but there's nothing that prohibits construction traffic on Carr. And as we get closer to this process, I'd like it just out and out prohibited. We cannot have diesel fuming 5 households several times a day. Thank you. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Dan.
I had a question first. If you could go to the map that shows the trees. Yeah, there it is. So you said it was a mix of existing and new. Is that like on both sides? Is that right?
I'll ask the applicant to correct me if I say this wrong. I know the trees down along this side of the southern half of Sweet Bay are proposed as new.
Is that where those, I think they're like little magnolia trees now?
So there are some, the ones on this section are existing, but they're proposing to add some additional ones, same type of tree.
Okay.
Same type of tree. What I'm a little unsure of, and I'll turn to Jack, is I think some of these are proposed as new to kind of supplement what is existing already.
Okay. And the one in the middle there, is that big old tree?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
There are some, just to finish that thought, there were some smaller trees in not so good health in approximately this location that are being removed, but the big one a little further down would stay.
Okay. Mark, is this a good time to ask about some of the advisory board recommendations, or should I hold off till after we hear from the public on that?
Yeah, why don't we come back to those in a minute after. Alex?
Yeah, just following up on Dan's question. Now, the trees that are along Sweet Bay Place, as I recall, the ones that are existing, were required as part of the Roberson Place CUP. Am I not correct about that?
We went back and tried to discern exactly what happened there. There was some history there, some memories of the history there that we haven't been able to nail down in perfect fact in the files upstairs, if that's a fair way to put this.
Well, if memory serves me correctly, we twisted Mariana's arm and she said, yeah, I'll put him in. And that's why the answer, what I'm trying to get at is after we, whether it's on the record or not, got somebody to put him in, to pull him back up later seems kind of
if I can add a little bit to that.
Counterintuitive.
The other aspect we were trying to find a little more precise history on was along that southern boundary. I didn't go in and to any of the conditions or points of discussion in any level of detail, but one of those, since this has come up, is a request for flexible screening along that southern property line.
Okay.
Ask a follow-up question by
Sure.
So is it, the proposal is to dig up those trees and replace them with other trees?
No. Leave all the trees there would remain, just to add additional trees.
Oh, okay. Okay. Just making sure.
But don't yank them up to put in another sidewalk 5 years later.
Okay. One across the street. That's why I asked the question.
Right.
Right.
There's a sidewalk on the other side of the street
right
now. Okay. Let's hear from the applicant.
Sure. The wrong button. 1 second. There you go.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
I appreciate both Trish and Marty's summary. I'm Jack Haggerty, and we are happy to be here this evening. And as I said, I thought staff did a good job of presenting the points. Tonight, we're here to discuss, and I'm hopeful, receive approval on three proposed actions. You've heard about the three of them, and I'm going to talk a little bit about everything everybody said and about the project and hopefully go quickly and then let you all double back and ask questions. Of the three proposed actions, though they're all applied for concurrently, they've all arrived before you simultaneously, but they might best be understood in the following sequence, and this is what Mike was saying on it. The first action suggested by staff and assented to by the owners early in the application project was to split off the proposed lot for the Alberta from the Carmel lot proper. The result of this is that we have this request to allow certain specific nonconformities to remain at the mall property. The first one are the nonconforming width of the sidewalks. Those would be the sidewalks that are along Weber Street and Greensboro Street. We would ask them to remain as they are. Removal of the widening of these sidewalks would entail loss of parking. This is along North Greensboro. Loss of parking, loss of trees. Along Weaver Street, we would see loss of this improvement here, the crepe myrtles. Further down Weaver Street on this same side, we would see all these plantings go. There's numerous large trees fairly close to the sidewalk. Continuing down, you can see additional trees would require utility work here. And then further down, it would require the loss of parking. This would be the southern end of the parking off Weaver Street at the mall, as well as additional trees. So we would like to ask that existing condition there be left as it is. Another one that was mentioned in your summary, and I'm not sure Marty didn't mention it, was we do have an excess of compact parking spaces, and I'll just touch on that, saying the owners would like not to restripe the parking lot. Certainly there's an expense involved in restriping, but turning the compact spaces into standard will occasion, again, the loss of spaces, and given what appears to be a parking crunch on an already pressed lot, the loss of parking seems like a bad result. And though the spaces in question are compact ones, we think a surfeit of compact spaces is no drawback, as cars, in fact, do seem to be getting smaller. Finally, bringing the lighting into compliance is a large expense would entail additional lighting to maintain the current security-level lighting. So that deals with the three nonconforming issues at the mall we're asking for. The next issue in this sequence is the conditional use rezoning that is required for the Alberta. Trish explained this issue pretty well. Conditional zoning, as she said, and we've understood it, means that it applies to the whole lot. As was pointed out, the lot does have two different zoning lots on it. I'm going to put this up here briefly, this being Sweet Bay, this being Roberson. Trish is exactly right that this line here demarcates currently B1G and B2 zoning. And with conditional zoning, the whole lot must be taken into consideration. And it would go, as I said, the B1G would then extend all the way to Roberson Place, and the lot would go from having two zoning districts to the one. B1G is a general business zoning district and is designed to be in close proximity to existing single-family residences or neighborhoods, in this case, East Carr Street and Maple Street, East Carr coming off here and Maple here. And though we propose, also by having the whole lot B1G, we do get sufficient area to meet the density requirements of 3,000 square foot per dwelling unit. This allows us 30 units, though we're only proposing 23 dwelling units. The two final points on the conditional rezoning is that this conditional zoning is, as Trish pointed out, consistent with current zoning. It merely expands it. And the second point follows on the first. And though we're proposing expanding the extent of the B1G, as we said, it would come down to here,
on the lot, any future changes, and I'm unaware of any that are under consideration, but any future changes, should they be proposed, would have to come before this board for approval. In short, this requested conditional rezoning is bringing nothing in that wouldn't have to go past three-year review at a future date. The third portion of this proposal is the application for the Alberta. The building is, as Marty described, a four-story building of approximately 46,000 square feet, divided roughly evenly amongst four floors. Each is a little over 11,500 square feet. We've heard from a number of different groups in this process, and we've tried to come up with a project that satisfies them as much as we can. There are those who want no project or only a small one, and to this all we can say is that the zoning, even before conditional zoning, and numerous, if not all, the town documents, call for an expanded downtown, a number mentioning Roberson Street specifically. We've heard from the board on increasing the amount of commercial square footage, and we went from 50% of residential square footage on the first floor to almost 66%, or 6,800 foot, rounded up, of commercial space on the first floor. Except for the lobby entrance and the residences, which I'm going to show you here, these hatched areas are all commercial square footage. This is along Roberson Street, and this is along Sweet Bay. This is the entrance to the residences, and this is their community room. So along our public right-of-ways, we put commercial spaces all along the first floor. We think this is the best place for them, and we believe when we look at the building itself, we think that we've designed for them to be commercial office residential spaces, and we think they'll contribute to the streetscape and to the commercial environment of the downtown area.
Jack, if I may, what's in the back side along the EMS building? That
right along in here?
Yeah.
What you're seeing is commercial. I hate pulling these out of order, but I'll do it. I may have to fumble and find my way back, but I have a larger drawing of it.
I can be patient if you're going to get to it. That's, I mean.
Well, I thought I was, but I'll talk from it from here. What we have here is this is all commercial property. This is the lobby that stretches around. These are two units right here, two residential units. Then these are service spaces for the residential units. And they're back along the corner, as you can tell, closest to Carr and Maple Avenue.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure, of course. We have heard from and tried to anticipate the neighbors. It would have been possible to place a five-story building here. We chose not to do so. This drawing shows you the possible envelope looking from Roberson Street that the building could have been. We chose not to do the fifth story, which would be this space in here. And it's partly because we've always seen this building as a transition from downtown along Roberson Street, moving toward the residences. We didn't want to go to five floors. We wanted to keep it down to four. We think that helps ease that transition. And then we also chose not to build all the way to the property line where the EMS is. This allows for a pedestrian alley or a pedestrian walk there, and it also gives us something of a service alley we don't believe would be used all the time, so we think it'll mainly be open for pedestrian traffic. At one point when we first started on this project, we had dumpsters in there trying to keep them away from the neighbors, and we also had an 8x8 transformer in there that Duke Power is requiring us to put, both of which we've moved out of there, trying to keep it open as a usable space. Our covered bike parking is there, etc. The previous application that was mentioned by Marty was for an 18,000-square-foot building that was all business. By having residential be the dominant use in this, we will create significantly less traffic than the earlier proposal. And we know that's been of a concern to the neighbors. About the building, we have 23 units. There are 4 one-bedroom, 16 two-bedroom, and 3 three-bedroom units. The one-bedrooms are about 800 to 1,000 square foot. The two-bedrooms are about 1,200 square foot, and the three-bedrooms are about 2,000 square feet. As I mentioned earlier, we have the 6,800 square foot of commercial space. Here's that larger drawing that I mentioned earlier that I thought I could come up with. Again, this is Roberson, Sweet Bay, and these are commercial spaces here. Then the formal entry into the residences is off Sweet Bay, and that pull-off that Marty mentioned, and I'll be able to show it to you also, is for the use of that. Also, we know UPS trucks and everybody else are going to duck in there and stay out of the way. I want to show you this, that the owners have seen this building, even though there are two separate lots, the owners of this have always seen this basically the Carmel thing as kind of one giant mixed-use project. And I want to show you some numbers on that. Including the Carmel Mall existing, we have existing offices at approximately 55,000 square foot of property and the existing retail at 88,000. This is at Carmel Mall. Including the Alberta, and I took the 6,800 square foot of commercial and broke it up between office and retail. But that pushes them, in this instance, up to about 57,000, almost 93,000, with the residential component coming in a little under 40, or just 21% of it. So we see this whole thing as one big project, and we see it as a large mixed-use project, and residential doesn't loom very large in that percentage. I want to move to the site plan of the project. You've seen one of those already. Here's another version. As Marty pointed out, we have Roberson Street up here. We have Sweet Bay here. We have large sidewalks in front of this. This drawing does not show the planning strip because we became aware of the difficulty with the Roberson Street plan, and we've had no problem trying to accommodate it. It's just that the staff has taken some time in trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that the paved portion of Roberson Street does not center on the right-of-way, and it becomes rather awkward to deal with. But we don't have any objection to the planning strip at all. So you're seeing large sidewalks along here, also large sidewalk here. Then this indentation is the entrance for the residential portion of the building, with the pullover as mentioned. Marty mentioned the sidewalk goes to 8 foot, but does widen out. We have some low landscaping walls, some planning. This is all part of our UA and DLA requirements. We're proposing street trees. We have an 8 foot sidewalk back here. Then this would be the walkway. We do have a place for a large truck to pull in here, which is required a loading space, but we have bicycle storage, et cetera, all along there, covered bicycle storage. In regard to the DLA UA questions, Marty showed this drawing also. During our discussion, which you all heard about DLA and UA, we mentioned that the Alberta didn't have problems meeting the higher standards, but this lot is unusual in having this much open space in it downtown. This is the large, heavily planted area that screens up the parking lot from Maple Avenue, and the owners have no intention of touching it. They want to maintain that as a screen. They want to try to remain good neighbors. Looking at the building elevations, and again, I'm more than happy to go double back on any of this. This is the Roberson Street elevation. This would be the Sweet Bay elevation along Roberson Street. The architectural standards require 60% glazing, and this actually is only 58%, as extensive as it is. And then coming along here, where there's commercial space here, we also have extensive glazing. This would be the entry to the residential portion. Here's our landscape wall with plantings behind it. It's a large enough wall to sit on. It contains plantings. Then these would be entrances to further commercial spaces on down Sweet Bay. The material's predominantly brick. The units have quite a bit of window in them. We're proposing two-color brick. We have some ceramic tile and glass block in what is the elevator lobby. But we think the materials are very consistent with what you see downtown. As Marty pointed out, the Appearance Commission was enthusiastic about the building. We've worked, this building is, this is the rear elevation, I'm sorry, rear and side elevation. This is the part that would face the parking lot. What we've done here, we've made a few changes again, is we opened up this balcony here to step down to give at least the feeling of the height being reduced toward Maple Avenue and Carr Street, so the building doesn't feel quite as tall on that corner. And this building is also one that the planning board recommended we try to follow Triangle J guidelines, which are extensive, and I'm acquiring familiarity with them. But we are definitely heading toward a green building. The question for us is how green it will be. But we're very much looking at a high-performance envelope from a cool roof or a high-performance roof. We're considering the use of aerated autoclave concrete as the backup onto brick veneer. Our windows, of course, would be energy efficient. When I have brick local, those are some of the requirements that you, when you become familiar with this, they like local materials that aren't trucked very far. Our interior finishes, we'll be looking at possibly using clay, bamboo flooring, etc. We'll be sorting this out as we get into working drawings if we get approval on the project. And we'll be going through all these systems, but looking at plumbing, mechanical, electrical, etc. We've worked really hard to make what we think is an attractive and appropriate building for the site, meaning we tried to think of the downtown. We tried to consider Maple Avenue and East Carr Street. We don't believe this building will have a negative impact on the town or on adjoining properties, and we've submitted a letter which came included in your packet from Paul Snow of Analytical Consultants, who's an independent and certified real estate appraiser. And we think this building will be in harmony with other proposed buildings, that it is certainly consistent with the land use plans and policy documents of the town of Carrboro. There was a question about the staging, and I think it would be all right if we heard a condition about it, but basically we're proposing to put a fence around the building and also this part of the parking lot. This is a fence here, so the construction traffic would be obliged to come down Roberson Street, Suite Bay, to enter this area. And this would remain as open parking for the mall employees and customers here. Then what sounded hard to do without this drawing is that this is our construction entrance, and it will also be a driveway. When the building nears completion and this becomes available, we'll stop to put up two small gates here. And these gates are to enclose reserve parking for the residences of the condominium solely. And that's just right in this area right here. I want to talk about some of the proposed conditions and comments just straight through. And then if you all want to double back and talk about specific ones, that's, of course, fine. And we'll be ready to speak on them. There are 13 conditions recommended by the staff, and some of these are included in advisory board comments. If I don't mention a specific condition, it means the owners accept that condition. I want to talk about condition number 2, affordable housing. There are 23 units proposed, and 15% of that number is 3.45 units. We have met numerous times with Robert Dowling, who's here this evening, and we would like to propose that to satisfy this requirement, we make a payment of 3.45 units in lieu. Just earlier tonight, we had no idea about the Ballantyne, this discussion coming up, but clearly there seems to be a need for capital in this investment, and we would propose that we do 3.45. There's talk about rounding up, rounding down in the ordinance on this issue. The reason we're asking just to do 3.45 is because it, of course, is impossible to manage physically since you can't donate 0.45 of a unit, but it does work as a payment in lieu. We are not requesting any of the incentives or bonuses that the ordinance offers for affordable housing. We've not taken advantage of any of those, and consequently, we feel that we can make this request of saying 3.45 units payment in lieu. Regarding the additional points, I'd like to say the following. There was a mention of the community room. It will be used for children activities if residents of this building have children. In other words, the disposition and use of this room should be determined by the users. The owners have discussed the dedication of sidewalk along Roberson Street and Sweet Bay and do not want to make the dedication. The owners are desirous to retain ownership of these spaces so as to ensure quiet and peaceful enjoyment of the property by both commercial tenants, their customers, and the residents of the buildings. In their desire not to dedicate the sidewalks on Roberson and Sweet Bay, they feel they are speaking for their future tenants, customers, and residents. The owners are aware that they'll be responsible for continuing upkeep, maintenance of the sidewalks to the standards of the town of Carrboro, and are willing to take care of the planning strip in Roberson Street. The owners also request not to have a sidewalk. There's discussion in there along Sweet Bay, and this would be the sidewalk that's shown south of the driveway.
Jack, as you go through these, can you go ahead and reference the number on there? Because you're ripping on through these.
I'm sorry, I don't know which one that is that discusses the Sweet Bay down, the sidewalk.
Right,
down
so you're not looking at the same document. Okay,
number
that's fine.
Number 2 points of discussion on the alternative one, attachment into, I think,
this
number 2.
This is not working from the same sheet.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
No points of discussion rather
right.
than conditions
right.
that are
right.
not.
I'm moving through conditions and points of discussion from the staff sheet.
Okay.
And you all had that correct. These trees here are existing magnolias. These are ones that we are proposing here, and this is the area where we're talking about the sidewalk. We resist this because we find this to be a difficult area to install a sidewalk. These trees really aren't really so little, and as you can see, there's topography. It would also include the loss of parking spaces to it. So we would like to go to up with our proposal, which includes extending the line of magnolias further down. This has the benefit of shading the parking lot and screening it. So we think that's a desirable way to do this. There's been some of the discussions about sufficient screening on the lot. We believe there is. Certainly we're willing to enhance this screening here. We have no intention of touching any of this. We are adding trees up at this end of the building, up at the parking lot here. We will be adding buildings. There was some discussion, and Marty was touching on it here. In the 90s, somebody was asked to increase the screening between Roberson Place and this parking lot. This was done. We know that, but we think some of it at some point may have been removed, not by Carmel Mall, but possibly by the original tenants in his homes. We don't know. But we know that it was requested, it was installed, and if it's not there now, we don't know quite why. We also would like to leave the lights at 15 foot in height. To our knowledge, there's been no complaints, and the owners would just as soon leave them as they are. I do want to touch on the discussion that was about the driveway here. This is a driveway, and it functions as a driveway now. The owners would prefer to keep it. There's been a tremendous crush on parking lately, and their feeling quite strongly about this is that should this be turned into a public right-of-way, they'll lose control of it. And it's already hard enough for them to control parking for residents, employees and tenants of Carr Mill when they're already distant from the building. And they feel certain that they will lose further control of this parking lot. I think many of you know that this parking lot is used by a number of commuters to UNC who park and take bicycles, et cetera. It's already a hard one to maintain. And the maintenance of that is one that would be made exponentially more difficult were that taken as a public street. I think I've covered it all pretty quickly for you, and I certainly am happy to go back on other points, put up drawings that you want to see, or anything.
I got a question for the attorney.
Joel.
Mike, could we fashion a pedestrian walkway access requirement?
I don't understand.
Well,
what are you speaking of?
Keep that one up.
Up.
Right in between where that. They were talking about the, yes.
Oh, in other words, without that being a public street, could there still be some type of public pedestrian easement through there, that type of thing?
Right.
If the developer wishes to create that, I don't see why not. I mean, as a practical matter, obviously it will be there. As a legal matter, they could certainly create that, just as other places have done, where you have, in essence, I think we did that over recently when we closed the street. We had sort of
Right. Todd Street,
where
Right.
we have privately owned but a public access easement, pedestrian easement goes through there. So the answer, I guess the short answer is yeah, it's possible to fashion that. As I say, unless it's physically closed off, I don't know how, as a practical matter, one would block it. I mean, assuming it's open, it can be used.
Right.
As a practical matter.
I was just going to add that based on advisory board discussions, in addition to that driveway having public access, the strip along the EMS, right, exactly. Because people will be using it, it makes sense to have that as part of the conditions. Part of the conditions, just right, the alley. Just as Todd Street, we protected the right for people to have access.
Public access, right. Some type of public access, okay.
The owners on this one are going to have they're going to have concern about that simply because they'll worry about how the residents are treated by people using it. In other words, if that becomes a passageway for people leaving Tyler's very late at night and noisily, they're going to have concerns about that.
How are they going to monitor it anyway?
They're going to do that anyway.
Right. They're people that are choosing to live downtown. Right.
We can get into.
We're not ready for discussion.
Yeah, we have, I think, a number of people who want to speak on this. But are there other questions for the applicant right now?
Are there any plans? I understand and can appreciate the plans to gate off that part of the parking for residents. Are there any plans to gate off the street, to put a gate? At where Carr Street comes in.
On these points, what you
mean? Yeah.
I don't believe there's any plans right now to do so, though I will say that the owners are concerned about the parking situation. 300 East Main is 120 spaces short, and the parking crunch on them becomes very high.
Right, and it also...
They become very few at this point.
But the spillover would go to, Sweet Bay... or car people, so we need ways of preventing people from parking on those two streets that are coming for this. And a gate, for something to turn into a gated community right downtown Carrboro would be really antithetical to who and what we are. So later on, when we're discussing the permit, we'll come up with a way of not allowing, I don't think we permit gated communities anyway, but... Anyway, okay, well, let's hear from the public.
Come back to that.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions for the applicant right now? Obviously, we can ask him other questions later. There will be questions. But
well, I just have one question.
Sure.
Could you give me an example of, you described the construction material as the majority of it brick, two colors, and ceramic block. Can you give me an example of ceramic block?
Ceramic tile.
Tile. Okay.
I think on 605 East Main at their entrance lobby, the lower left-hand corner of that building, they do have some tile on the exterior there.
Okay. I'm sorry. I wrote down block and you meant tile, yeah. So that's my fault. Sorry.
It would just be regular ceramic tile.
Okay.
Probably like a slate tile or something like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Jack, I know that something else that was discussed is for downtown livability and urban amenities were benches, and I know you didn't mention that here now. Is that something that the owners are still interested in?
I think the owners would certainly would find their way to supplying a few benches. They were mentioned by the planning board.
Right, because you have several spaces that, you know, yeah, would be right.
There's large areas here.
Yeah.
I think if you look at Carmel Mall, you notice they take pretty good care of it, and I don't think the owners would find that an objectionable request on the part of the board. They also discussed, I was there, we were all there.
Right.
Discussed and large potted plants and things like that.
Yeah.
I think that's something they would entertain.
I also wanted to ask about the area adjacent to the parking, that bit of open space there. What the lower part of the L?
Here,
no.
Here?
Yeah. What size is that?
Pretty good amount of square footage. I couldn't give you a dimensional statement right now. I think it's almost 3,000 square foot. And there's nothing proposed to happen to that at all. As Trish pointed out, that it is fair to say that other than these gates for the enclosed area here and the dumpster, there's no change on the lower portion of this lot. None is proposed at all.
So is there any thought of maybe putting benches in that area, in that bottom L as well?
We've not discussed it because it diminishes the effect of the screening. It's pretty dense screening there. I think I can show you how dense it is, if I can figure out where those drawings are.
I was just thinking because it's transition to neighborhood.
This is that. It's going to be upside down. That's the lower part of the parking lot. And this is looking into that area you're discussing. It's right in. This is that whole screen along there. And there's no desire on the part of the owners to infringe upon that at all, to maintain it. It's photinias and deciduous and evergreen all mixed in there.
Okay. So far, I only have one person signed up to speak, but I have a feeling there may be a few others. James Carnahan, if you would come up first. And we'll...
Should I leave my visual material up here? I could be concerned some interest in this.
Yeah, could you?
Just wanted to report briefly on the planning board comments.
Thanks.
Planning board is generally very enthusiastic about this, and I'm happy to answer questions about any of the items. I had intended to comment in a little more detail about the last one, but that may be moot. If it is your decision to accept a payment in lieu for the affordable housing, then the recommendation the planning board had made would be irrelevant. But I will just say this about that. We became aware in the course of our discussion that although the proposed affordable housing units were one bedroom, that there's a much greater need for two-bedroom affordable units. And so the planning board had recommended that those units be made two-bedroom units and that if necessary, rather than to sacrifice square footage in any of the other units, we recommended that they redesign and go to a fifth floor in order to gain the square footage in order to do that. And that's all I had to say.
Oh, that's getting way more.
Maybe all that gets said about that.
And it's moot anyway, so.
Well, it may or may not be.
It
may or may not be. We'll see about
anyway.
That. All right. Thanks very much, Jim.
Thanks, James.
Alan Virchick.
So I'm first, but I do want to speak.
Okay. Robert Dowling, were you going to speak on this?
Yes.
come on up.
Good evening. Robert Dowling, Orange Community Housing and Land Trust. I've met with the developer several times over a number of months, and we've talked about this 3.45 units or 4 units, and we've talked about doing a combination of payment in lieu and some units. I know it sounds odd for me to stand up here and say a payment in lieu makes sense instead of units, because I think in years in the past I've said the exact opposite. But as you all know, I've learned a lot in the last few years, and there are two overriding issues that I look at when I look at any development proposal. One is, how many condominiums do we need, and how many condominiums can we possibly sell? We have, I said earlier, 150 units coming to the land trust in the next 3 years. Of those, there are almost 100 condominiums, all of which are in Chapel Hill, and I know that some of you think of Chapel Hill and Carver as two very distinct places. From my vantage point, when we have to sell condominiums, I think of it as how can a land trust, a small organization, handle 100 condominiums? I don't know. We don't have the experience. Excuse me. We have 18 condominiums in our inventory of 126 houses. We're going to be expected to sell almost 100 in a period of 24 months. So every new one more condominium unit that I'm told, here, you get another one. I say, that's great. Isn't that terrific? How are we going to sell this? You know, who's going to buy it? How long is the person who buys it going to live in it? I suspect we're going to have a lot of young people who are working at or affiliated with the university, for whom it's going to be a transitional housing. Transitional meaning 3 years, 4 years. So if we have 100 condominium units and they turn over every 4 years, which may be a lot, then we have 25 condominiums coming back to us every year forever. That's something I think about. The other thing about condominiums is, how do we keep them affordable? I know how to set the price initially, but what I don't know, and the developer doesn't know, no developer knows, is what's going to happen with condominium assessments and special assessments 10 years from now and 20 years from now. We have projections, and we have spreadsheets that go out 30 years. It's hard to know how are we going to keep those units affordable. You all already know that with our existing inventory of 125 houses, we have a big challenge in terms of keeping those units affordable and well-maintained. That challenge approximates $3 million over a period of 25 years. You already know that. I know that. We need to come up with that money if these units are going to work, if they're going to be successful. Condominium units just pose a problem, a dilemma, and we're going to do the best we can. Having said all that, I think it would be very wise for the board to consider taking some, if not all, of these units as a payment in lieu. If you want to do 2 units and the 1.45 is a payment in lieu, or 1.45 units, 2 is a payment in lieu, or all 4, I could justify going either direction. The decision that would be most difficult for us would be if you all took the 4 units or the I don't know how you do 3.45 units, and that's just becomes part of our what we have to deal with. We'll deal with it. We'll do what you want us to do. But I think the best decision for affordable housing, and here's the affordable housing guy standing here saying that, is not to take all the units, because it's going to be very difficult to make it work. So I struggle with, where should I come down? Should I say to you, don't take any units, or split the difference? This is a building that's going to be desirable. It's in a great location, and people are going to want to live there, I think. So if we have to sell units, we'll sell units.
How much is the, if it were 3.45, how much would they be, how much would that be?
The payment lieu?
Yeah.
The town has an ordinance that defines how the payment lieu is determined. And briefly, the town ordinance says they ask Habitat for Humanity, Empowerment Incorporated, and the Land Trust to document how much we require to make a unit affordable.
Just give me a guesstimate amount.
We don't know yet.
Okay. Well, then don't tell me anything else if you don't know.
Okay, we're waiting for some information, okay. And we have to calculate an average. Well, we have an average from Orange Community Land Trust for the past year, and it was about $35,000 per unit subsidy. And that's what we're supposed to calculate. Okay. And you all will... I mean, this is a slightly different situation because they're not. This isn't a payment in lieu, because they don't have a requirement. They don't have. They're not maximizing their density. Mm-hmm. So, but the we're gathering the information to get to you so you can set a fee for that. But we don't have it yet.
Okay.
That's what we asked for.
Robert, where are these other condominium projects located that are coming in?
Greenbridge on Rosemary Street.
Chapel
There's 15 of them in Chapel Hill. Lot 5 in Chapel Hill, I think there's about 22, something like that. And East 54, which is the University Inn out on 54 near Meadowmont, is about 60.
Okay, so basically those three.
Those three total, almost 100 units.
Okay, thank you.
And as far as the payment in lieu is concerned, I'm not going to argue with Trish. She knows the ordinance better than I do. But a payment in lieu, in my mind, is how much money is required to produce a unit in lieu of getting a unit. And the $35,000 that we provided is the amount of cash subsidy that we used in the new units that we put in the land trust last year, which is, I think, only 7 units. Most of the 7, 4 of the 7, were a result of inclusionary housing policies. And so the amount of subsidy required was very low. In 2 instances, I think it was 0. In the ones where we developed the housing, the numbers were $75,000 or $80,000. So if you ask me what would it require for us, and I think you get similar answer from Dolores Bailey or Susan Levy, what would it take to build a unit? I think it would be more like $75,000 or $80,000, not $35,000.
So, Robert, when you talk about when we think about where our affordable housing should be, it makes a lot of sense that, you want it at Lot 5, you want it at Greenbridge, and you want it on Roberson Street. You don't want it. You want it in the suburbs because you want it everywhere, but maybe you want it where it's walkable, where there's transit. And I guess I'm wondering if among the projects you mentioned, given where the 54 East project is, it's not very far along, and there's a lot of affordable housing there, of which I know Mr. Perry is very proud. I wonder if it's I wonder if it's possible to get some payments in lieu there to go to Chapel Hill, for us to have a conversation with you and us in Chapel Hill. And I think in principle they would agree that it makes sense to have some of these units in downtown Carrboro, depending how territorial they want to get. I know if it was Alex, it would be tough going the other way. But anyway, you get what I'm saying.
Right.
I think that was a conversation that might be worth having. And
I would. It gets at a larger issue of you. I come to all of you all, and I try to advise you as best I can. And as I said, we're going to do what you all ask us to do. But there's 4 of you all, and there's only one of us. Chapel Hill, Orange County, Hillsborough, and Carrboro. Mm-hmm. And everybody has different wants and desires and philosophies. And I think what you're getting at, Dan, is maybe there should be, with regard to this organization, which is a 6-person organization, has limited capacity, mm-hmm. maybe you all should be more on the same page.
Right, but that's a little bit different question than the particular question that
I'm
asking.
Particular question of...
Because I talk to people every week who are frustrated homeowners or would-be homeowners who want affordable housing in downtown Carrboro. And, of course, there isn't any where there's prices level.
But does a one-bedroom condo serve their needs?
In some cases, yes. Many cases, no.
Well, there's plenty more depth to this issue, for sure.
Okay. We can follow up on that later.
Yeah. Let me ask. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
If you're here and haven't signed up, but you're here to speak on this item, if you would just raise your hand for just a second so I can get a full survey of who all is out there. All right.
Just to note that the car, the alarm from which keeps going off outside, is a silver Passat wagon, missing a few hubcaps.
That's what
been going on.
Possibly newly missing.
No.
All right.
Well, not my ride. Not my ride.
Not me. Okay. Mitch, do you want to lead us off here?
Yeah, my car is gone.
Hi, I'm Mitch Vercek, and I live on Maple Avenue. You're all being asked to consider a very big project right now, and this is the first of, well, it's not the first. I mean, you know, you've already looked at several others downtown, but I think this is the one that impacts existing neighborhoods maybe a little bit more than some of the others. I mean, I know I'm being a little bit prejudiced because I live on Maple Avenue, but obviously this is the first of several. There's also the property next to the rescue squad. There's the property where Andrews Rigsby Hardware store used to be. And so, so what you agree to now is really going to sort of set, I think, precedent and some guidelines for future decisions as well. A couple of questions that I didn't really get answers to, although I appreciate the Board of Aldermen asking all the questions, is that I don't know where the HVAC units are on this. Can, mm-hmm. Jack, can you?
The dancing units would be on the roof.
On the roof, okay.
Yeah.
And the dumpsters?
Dumpsters are
at the front of the parking lot.
Right. And the dumpster location, as a result, as we said, we were unable to reach an agreement with the EMS people at this time to do this. Their concern was maneuvering the trailer they have there. So they were not agreeable to putting the dumpster here. So we began to look. We had heard the neighbors from the first project, and we tried to move it just as much this way as we possibly could. Of course, it has a dumpster screen around it,
right.
Et cetera.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a tough place to put anything. Is there more screening then in that that gated off corner of the parking lot towards the south side? It looks a little. Oh no, it isn't. That's the existing part.
Existing.
I know where it is. Okay, I know what it is. Okay. I'm a little concerned about this whole notion of a private road. Everybody on Maple Avenue right now pretty much uses, cuts through the parking lot. If you want to go east towards Chapel Hill on Main Street, that's the way to do it. And my thought was that we would all be able to pretty much use that that thoroughfare cut over to Roberson Street or cut over to Sweet Bay there? Is that what it's called? Sweet Bay? Sweet Bay, and then continue on and exit by the Armadillo Grill there. So I'm not sure why that needs to go private other than to get around some restrictions or something like that. I think it's a bad idea. Generally speaking, on a lot of these traffic matters, this is not the redevelopment of Paris in the 19th century. I mean, the Paris that, not this Paris, but the other one. Houseman, he leveled whole neighborhoods, right, in order to put up these glorious boulevards and really nice proportions and everything. We can't do that anymore. We can't just step on property owners and say, hey, we're going to take your land. And so you have to, I think the challenge for the alderman is going to have to be to figure out where the low-hanging fruit is as far as alleviating the traffic problems that you are going to have as you start putting down, you know, 23 units here, 40 units there, all of the arts center and performance bicycle property, all of that stuff. I wrote kind of a PO'd letter to the board a while back when the issue came up of extending not Sweet Bay, but Purple Leaf, I guess, Purple Leaf, down through the Tri-M warehouses. And, you know, I really thought that was a piece of low-hanging fruit that should have been grabbed right then and there, because the fact that it was kind of treated as tepidly as it was, I think just simply strengthens the emboldens the neighbors to marshal their resources to deny it once again when it comes up. And you're really going to need to just create whatever opportunities you have to allow other accesses outside of Main Street and outside those collector roads that exist right now, because the traffic will just get worse and worse downtown. And let's see. I think that's probably about all I really had to say about it. But I do appreciate the sensitivity that developers have shown towards the neighborhood. Certainly among all the other projects that I've seen, it seems to be the most in tune with the existing neighbors. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mitch.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gary Kramling, and I live on Sweet Bay in Roberson Place. I'm very enthusiastic about this project. I think it is exactly the type of mixed-use, high-dense project that we need in exactly the right place, and I'm absolutely supportive of it. And I think it's only gotten better the more I've learned about it. I do have just a few questions that I think Jack can answer for me. I'm wondering, first of all, if there's a more detailed landscaping plan than what we're seeing here tonight, or is this the entirety of it?
No, there is a more detailed one where species are called out, and it's part of the application. I'm happy to get you a sheet of it.
Okay. It hasn't been stated, and maybe it's just been my assumption, but the entire parking lot as it exists today is going to be resurfaced?
We don't have any intention of doing that.
No, we can answer for the record.
You can't, if they, you know, you can't hear it on the tape. But we can.
So none of it is going to be resurfaced?
When maintenance is determined to be needed, it will be resurfaced. We might do some patching as it is now. I think there's some cracking on the lower end. But we've not discussed it.
Okay. I guess in order to continue to be supportive of this, you know, being a resident of Roberson Place and walking up and down this all the time, that parking lot is literally the biggest eyesore in our neighborhood. And the plantings that are there today don't come close to sufficiently screening our neighborhood from this parking lot. And now with a conditional use rezoning where we're going to B1G, you know, you've got commercial space right up against residential space, and there does need to be some sort of reasonable buffer in order to protect the residents that are there, as well as the new residents that are hopefully going to be coming in across the street in two other buildings you're familiar with. So I guess especially along Sweet Bay Place, where there's very little planting, especially in light of there being no current requirement to resurface that lot, I'd like to see something much more substantial done there, both in terms of the trees that you're planting, but also something lower, so there really is a better screen for the people there.
Along the southern portion of that, below where the existing magnolias are, we're proposing additional magnolias. So if you imagine the upper portion, the southern portion will look like that in 10 years. just pretty dense. Those trees, the picture.
Right, but I think even lower
okay.
would really help out.
Okay.
And I don't know the lady who lives in the house there at the southern end of the lot, but I definitely feel for her also having that expansive parking lot right next to that house. And
we have a letter from her. Is that right?
That's correct.
In the zeros. Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay. And then my last question would be just to state what I've heard other people say, whether this is a private or public road. I especially think of bicyclists coming off of the bike path, that this is kind of a natural place for them to duck down and head across Carr Street to then join the other bike path on the other side of town. So I would at least like to see that connectivity remain for those folks who could definitely use it and stay off the busier streets. Thanks.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Gary. Ellen Virchick and then okay. Then Bob and then in the back.
Good evening. I'm Ellen Virchick, and I live on Maple Avenue, too. I have a couple of questions, and it's not really so much related to this particular building, the Alberta, but just the future as, you know, what happens? What happens once this building goes up and then other buildings follow? And I'm wondering if you're really thinking along the lines of not just this one development, which looks very nice, but if you're thinking of this whole area down the road and what's going to be coming down the line. One of the things, a couple of things that concern me, and I'll start with the first one, which is I unfortunately missed Jack's presentation because I had to go walk my dog. And it occurred to me while I was walking my dog that probably a lot of people who are in this new building are probably going to be dog lovers just like I am too. And I hope you won't poo-poo the idea, but I'm wondering where those dogs are going to be going. And I suspect that people on their, you know, in a hurry to get to work every morning are going to be trotting their dogs down Maple Avenue in great numbers. Already that's happening. And, you know, there's no green space around that building for people and their pets. Okay, that's one small thing, but it impacts us on Maple Avenue a lot. It's already kind of an issue. The second thing is, and I apologize if I missed this, Carr Street, it's a lane. It's not really a street. It's a lane. It has historic homes on it, mill houses. The whole scale of that little area is really endangered by these big buildings that are coming online. And I just really want you to think about what that's going to look like and what's that going to do to the character of Carrboro, because it will really change it. I mean, the traffic is going to be horrific. And I suspect that all of this development will force you to make improvements, to widen roads, that you might not really want to have to do, but you're going to be forced to do. So I really hope you'll think about that. And then the last thing that I can think of right this minute is, and I said this to Jack, and he said, well, we don't have any plans for that. But I can't help but think that you're going to have plans for it. Is, you know, down here in this parking lot, which is already, you know, parking's already an issue What's going to stop them from feeling the necessity to put up a parking deck there? I mean, you're going to need parking, and there's only a few places that parking can go, and that seems like a very logical and likely place for it. Maybe not this year or next year, but 5-10 years down the road, when you know, when we get a 5-story building on the corner of Carr and Greensboro, we get this 4-story building, we get, I mean, you know what's coming on. And I just want you to make sure that you're thinking about all of this. And, you know, the quality of the people who are here already, I hope that makes a difference to you too, because I personally think we're going to be impacted negatively by a lot of this growth. I mean, you know, our quality of life, our, you know, the quiet enjoyment of our homes is going to be impacted by all this growth. So just for your consideration, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks, Ellen. Robert, and then I can't see who it is in the back there. But
Mark.
Oh, Mark. Martha. Yeah.
Can you tell us where we're from? The Abbots are about to give us a trip to Best We Know.
Yes.
I'm actually quite impressed with the planning that they're putting in before you here. I watched it a couple years ago when they tried to put in their 2-story, 3-story office building. I have the advantage of being intimately familiar with the area, of being an employee of a business that worked over in the Carr Mills section for about 10 years. Recently moved, so I'm not there anymore. However, I am quite familiar with the parking lot and the traffic flow through there. I do have concerns, as I'm hearing from you, about what to do about the public access with that side street. Let me find the pointer. Through here, I wish I could offer an answer to you. I understand their concerns about whether to keep it private or not. I would have concerns if they keep it private that they might consider gating that off, and that would be an issue. If they have concerns about protecting their parking down here to restrict it to the, I can see where they might consider putting a gate there, mm-hmm. which would give them access control for mall employees, et cetera. I am pleased to see that they will gate off and restrict to about 30 spaces to the resident owners. One big advantage I see of that, it is kind of restricting the owners to maintaining one vehicle. And in a downtown area, that's an advantageous. So on the outskirts, I can see they might, you have multiple families needing more vehicles. But being in the downtown area, you're kind of in, you have less of a need of multiple vehicles, larger vehicles. And a case in point, being downtown, I recently saw a reference to a program in this area called the Zip Card. And somebody mentioned that they haven't used the car, they used the Zip Card, and they used it to take a trip down to Florida. And I didn't realize they could use it long distance, but it's... Zip cards is a mechanism where you buy into a program where you can temporarily rent by the hour a vehicle for incidental basis, and it's used by any multiple people having one vehicle. I do have one concern with my expertise, and it's not necessarily to this project, but I'd like the board to give some consideration to how this might be handled, and that's the intersection of Robinson and Sweet Bay. Right now, it's kind of no man's land as far as vehicles, traffic, and bicycle traffic trying to get to the bicycle path there. And I'd like to encourage some consideration of some sort of traffic control at that intersection, such as a 3-way stop, something. And consider, I know it's not tied to what's before you tonight, but give future consideration to some sort of plan at that intersection. I'll try to limit my comments to you so you can proceed tonight. And
thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Martha.
see you affirm that the evidence you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge.
Yes, thank you. I'm Martha Arnold. I also live on Maple Avenue, and I just have three brief points. Some of them will are really just reiterating things that other folks have said. One specific thing that I'm just not sure about, and that's a commitment not only to providing screening but maintaining that screening. And I don't know if maintaining is part of the conditional use permit. I know Jack was talking about screening that should have been done or was done and disappeared in Robeson Place. So I'd like to see that added, particularly because the screening on Maple Avenue are trees that seem to be dying right now. Just a general comment, and I don't know what the ordinance is on this, but I sure would like to see mixed use be more than 1-8, commercial to residential. I understand the overall argument that this fits in within Carr Mill, which is a big commercial space, but that's existing commercial space rather than creating new commercial space. I mean, it would be great to have two stories of commercial and office space if that's a goal to create more commercial space downtown. And finally, just to reiterate the person that spoke before, as a walker and a bicycler, and I think this is more infrastructure than a problem for this development, is the corner of Robeson and Sweet Bay, but also Carr Street. I mean, two cars really can't drive down Carr Street. You know, you really have to slow down and let the other person pass.
So you want us to widen Carr Street?
I don't. But I want you to think about what you're allowing in terms of traffic and what it's going to be like for people turning left. You know, the same problems that come up every time something, a development in this area comes up. The inability to turn left safely from Carr onto Greensboro, onto South Greensboro. And the width of the street. Mm-hmm. And, no, I would hate to see it wide, especially since it would probably go into the Carr Street neighborhood, a residential neighborhood. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks,
Mark. All right. Ellen, if you want to speak, come on up. You need to be sworn, though.
I know. Sorry.
It's okay.
You solemnly swear or affirm the evidence you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge.
Okay, where do you want?
Here, you can stand right there.
Actually, yes. You're serious.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Guys, you know how hard it is to find an affordable house around here?
Yes.
For an affordable condo around here for me? This would be a perfect building for me to have a place. I mean, I just can imagine me in there or something, someplace affordable. I really want to get out and be on my own. And it's hard. I really and truly think that this is, you know, if you all make the mistake, you all make a mistake, y'all don't go for affordable housing downtown. Please do. For me. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
I just had to.
God. Appreciate it. You get to hear from the end user every now and then. It's good.
Jack? I have two citizens sent me emails. I'd like to just officially get them into the record. The first one's from Bland Holman, who's in Charleston right now and can't get up here. He lives on the corner of Maple and Carr and feels very strongly about not having construction traffic. Bland's recalling that as a condition during the last CUP that was restricted. And that he thinks that folks should use Sweet Bay. Also, and we've touched on this before, the green screen along Maple, who anybody that lives there knows Baxter, and according to Baxter, it's dying. So, but maybe we need to replace that with something that'll grow right. Also, concern about the dumpster, but he wanted us to make sure that the dumpster had been moved and that was written into the permit. he wrote about lighting, and really is opposed to any lighting being higher than 15 feet and feels like there are some properties close by, not Carmel, where that hasn't been followed on the other side of Greensboro Street, and that's a real issue. I also got an email from Elsie Vihe, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and she said she had two questions. They just moved in. The new project looks great because it will increase the vibrancy, and she loves that it's within walking distance. Her concerns regard parking, access, and traffic. She's concerned that there be adequate parking allowed for the new development so that overflow doesn't go down Carr and Greensboro Street. And again, will access be available to the development from Carr Street? She hopes that Carr Street will dead end before the development. And allowing access from Carr would cause a great deal of traffic onto Maple and encourage folks to park on Maple and Carr. And finally, the downtown streets are so congested. Will thought be given as to ways of alleviating this congestion in conjunction with evaluating plans for Alberta? She doesn't want the development to add to more gridlock downtown.
Thanks.
Yep.
If you could give those two to Sarah after meeting, that would be great.
To this, Sarah?
I just have a process suggestion if people are finish entering things into the record.
Yes.
I think the hour is too late for us to go into discussion.
Exactly.
I would rather take the input that we've received and just grind it through and continue the public hearing and to continue the discussion, and we can vote at another time.
Move and continue the public hearing.
Second.
Yes. Steve, do you have any suggestion about any specific date for that? Or
Sarah, I will forward you these.
Normally, it would be the next public hearing date, which would be the 25th, Sarah. But the board could do it sooner if you'd like. I will say that the agenda right now for September the 4th, which is just next week, might not be enough time, but the agenda right now for the 4th is fairly light.
I'm hip to that, if you will.
Whatever y'all want to do, I'm not
thinking. I think that would be, so somebody make a motion.
To move.
Second.
So we'll continue this until September 4th, is that motion?
Mm-hmm.
All right, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
I'd like to take a little stretch before we come back in for closed session, unless if that's okay.
I just need a few minutes for that.
Okay, if we only do need
it really is just a couple minutes. So closed session, which I'm proposing, is not the one that's on the sheet here,
right.
But is one that would involve the case of Carberg and Keeley. That's the case. That
so we have two
would be,
closed sessions?
So that, no, there was just one, and this would be
the appropriate
short.
Motion would be a motion.
Move we go into closed session to discuss a matter of litigation under attorney-client privilege.
Second.
Case of Town of Carborough versus Keeley. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. So